Welcome, ladies, gentlemen, and everyone, to Ladies with Gumption, episode 83, Things Fall Apart.
Which is like the book that you had to read in Honors English one summer, but not like it at all.
Oh, yeah!
Thank you for explaining the origin of the title. I think that should be a new segment. Every episode, you should tell us where the title came from. But I am Tatiana. I will be introducing this segment. And I am here with
Jessica
and May.
We are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. And you can find us at DCTV Gumption on Twitter, ladieswgumption@gmail.com if you want to send us a nice, long, juicy amount of feedback, or ladieswgumption.tumblr.com if you want to just send it to our Tumblr instead, because it's going to be the same thing either way. And of course, Ladies with Gumption is available wherever podcasts are available.
Podcasts are sold, but they're not. Yes. Sold at all.
They are free. iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Facebook, if we remember to post it. And if you don't want it to be free, because you're like, I just want to spend some money and then maybe eventually get a Game of Thrones episode out of it, where we like dissect the whole series, I guess, because it's about to end, you can find us at www.patreon.com/DCTVGumption. We've got new shirt designs, so if you would like to support the podcast in that way. And you can also find our Redbubble link on the Podomatic page. So, moving on to news. Batwoman has officially been ordered to series, which we thought had already happened. So Jessica is a psychic.
You're living in the future.
But now it is confirmed. Yes, we are the new spoiler TV, so you can get all your DC information here first. We'll just assume it, and then it will become true. Natalie Abrams, a.k.a. your local white woman, has been added to the staff as a staff writer of Batwoman. Like, to be fair, you know, your local lesbian, much like white lesbian, much like Caroline Dries, I suppose. But
yeah, this is, like, problematic. Like, I'm not excited about this at all, because already you have with Batwoman, there's this problematic history with fandom and Caroline Dries over the whole Vampire Diaries and the way that Bonnie Bennett was treated on that series as a whole. So right. There's already some problems coming in from a fandom, black woman, minority fandom perspective with regards to that. And then you had Natalie Abrams, who she's only had this one episode on Supergirl, so you don't really know how she writes, but there's problems with her as well from a fandom perspective, at least from like the Flash fandom, and the fact that she was one of the leaders or led the charge with the media in trying to force this Barry Caitlin narrative. And she was the one, like, she went as far as like misquoting Grant in articles to make it seem like Barry and Caitlin would go down a romantic path, and whenever she was at events she would pressure or ask Danielle, Angie Kreisberg, when is it going to happen and all this kind of stuff. So I really don't have a lot of faith in her writing, especially seeing as how this cast already has three people of color in, you know, very important lead roles. It doesn't make me very excited about, you know, Megan Tandy's position, because she is a romantic lead, and what will happen if, you know, random white woman love interest intermediary comes in to Kate's life and where that will go. So I'm not really, I don't know if they're like trying to not make me want to see this series, but I'm not really, knowing that the two main writers on the cast that we know so far are both like problematic white women, does not sit well with me. So we'll see.
Understandable.
I am not even whelmed. I am underwhelmed.
Yeah, I completely agree with, for all the reasons that you already so eloquently stated.
Calling me eloquent.
You are an eloquent person. That is true. But it is unsurprising. And now we shall move on to feedback, because that was the only piece of news. I think. Yeah.
Yep.
So.
Oh, but next week, I have one piece of news. Next week, next Thursday, I can't talk today, is the CW Upfronts. So we'll have lots of news, hopefully, from that.
Okay, perfect.
Also, I think it was this week, the Arrow fandom got their billboard up in Times Square. And
yes, they did.
Ford Mesa did some of the artwork for that. And so he showed pictures and, like, the video of it up on Times Square. So things they did that.
Okay.
Somebody else.
So I will read this 5-part thing from Tumblr. Thank you, Anon, whoever you are. And then I will find the emails. All right. So, one, curious to hear your thoughts, but I feel like the reason Cicada and Grace have been such disappointing villains is because, first of all, I really expected this to be an emotional story. A little girl's in a coma. She's a little girl in a coma because Team Flash failed to save her because Nora changed the timeline. I was expecting the entire team to be rocked and devastated. I expected them to visit her, Caitlin to visit her in the hospital, and the team to just be concerned about this little girl being in a coma. Season 4's finale had them all out protecting people on the streets. This was proof that they'd failed that. But the team is never very invested in Grace. She's just mentioned as an afterthought, and they aren't emotional about it at all, not even Nora, who caused it. I was completely floored they didn't have Cisco vibe Grace in her coma and instead chose to just give us Grace and Orlin flashbacks. Had they let Cisco vibe her and discover that, it would have made him and the team more emotionally invested. And now we have future Grace trying to kill them because Orlin hated Metas, but the team has never been shown to be emotionally upset about Grace being in a coma, so there's no weight to it. Little Grace could die from her coma right now, and I doubt the team would even care very much. That's what I got from how they handled the story. I guess my thoughts are, what was the point of having a child character in a coma if you're not going to make your cast of very emotional characters very emotional about it? The only one who cares about Grace is Cicada, but they made a massive mistake in not having the team invested in the little girl's recovery. Her being evil in the future would have meant a lot more if they actually cared about her. I mean, it's definitely true that the story would be more emotional if the team cared about Grace or if they had attempted to take care of her in the hospital, even after finding out that Orlin was Cicada, like maybe if they thought that would help Cicada, you know, change his mind. They kind of did it for like 10 seconds in that one episode before older Grace came. But if that had been a more prolonged storyline, then it would be more of a shock when older Grace actually wound up being the real / new Cicada.
Right. I wonder if it's like a chicken and egg thing, because if Team Flash actually cared about Grace, would she have become a serial killer in the future? Or if their neglect of Grace is why she becomes a serial killer. But I guess, you know, for that to be something, they would actually have to delve into that in the writing, yeah, and they don't. So
they'd have to point it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think the Flash writers think that deeply about their seasonal arcs regarding villains specifically. So that I guess they just had a bad track record with regards to villains specifically and how they, you know, they flesh them out over the course of the season. And I think one of the issues is in this, like you said, in this case, and on that, you know, there's no emotional tether, right? So it just kind of destroys a lot of it because there's no connection. Like this,
there's not even, like, they try to force that connection between Nora and Grace by having them psychically linked, but there's not really even between the two of them, there's no real emotional connection to say really why Nora is stuck in Grace's mind or vice versa.
And the thing is that they could have had an emotional connection because, you know, Grace didn't always like Orlin. You know, she didn't think that he was that great of an uncle until he became.
Right.
And then, right, you know, Nora had issues with her parents. So, like, they could have sort of paralleled some of that, or at least found some common ground in some way, especially when she went into her mind or whatever, but it didn't, so.
Nope, they did not. So yes, you are correct, Anon. Now moving on to emails, we've got Shang. This email is titled, "If Lena stabs me with her boot baton, it's because she caught me slipping." Supergirl feedback. One, it's a Supercorp event only. Everyone else can go home. Kara pretending she fainted and her glasses skewed, peak comedy. She's so corny whenever she has to fake it after using her powers. Reeves did the same thing for the Superman movie when they were at the alley and he pretended he fainted. It was so funny. Also, her taking off her glasses before she decided not to tell Lena, the writers fucking fooled me. The visual of Lena thanking Kara for being the only one who's honest with her while Kara is putting on her figurative mask in the background. I did.
Yes.
Two. The sheer terror on Kara's face when she realized that Lena was coming, and if she saw the pictures, she would have found out the truth. That panicked voice and the pain in her eyes, A-class acting. The sorrow in her eyes and the way she took off her glasses, while Lena spent the whole episode showing how much Kara meant to her and the horror in her voice when the explosion happened, that damn hug that shook me. They love each other so much, the reveal will send me down streaks. Yes. Three. Anyways, I'm a fool. This episode was a dry test. A dry test run and I fucking failed. I'm going to Kermit. Kara missed her chance and Lena probably is going to find out by other means for maximal angst. I'm pretty positive Lena's going to know in the finale. They're going to make it as traumatic as possible. Like, I don't know. Maybe they would kill Lex. Four. They have tried to avoid showing him as much as possible. So yes, I'm sure that he's headed down for death. Four. Yes. Me when Lena pulled out the baton from her literal killer heels. I'm both frightened and aroused. Five, I didn't like that only after 20 episodes did we get Alex's adoption storyline back. Her interactions with Kelly were so great, though. I like how the writers are building them up. The talk between them, wow, I got really emotional. Kudos to Natalie for writing that scene. She is the first queer woman that has written for the show, proving the point of how great diversity can be for a show. Six, wasn't too keen on the Lockwood stuff. James should have gone for his head during the previous episode. I did like him training with Brainy and Nia. They were so cute. Love the rescue by John. So, yes. Beautiful, beautiful thoughts. Shang. And I agree with most of them. Now we've got Paulina. Feedback for Flash. I hope you're all doing well and have had a good week. I've had a good week. How about you, ladies?
I was in Hawaii, so my week was great.
I personally had an okay week, but my friend's dad died, so that wasn't so great.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. But yeah, other than that, me personally, it's been okay.
Well, to preface Paulina's Flash feedback this week.
Sorry, Paulina.
I just want to compare my reaction to Game of Thrones on Sunday, which was rage towards the writing decisions made, with this week's Flash, which was indifference towards the writing decisions made. Regardless of how angry I am with The Last of the Starks, I would rather be that level of infuriated with the girl with the red lightning than utterly indifferent. Because I'm still thinking about that GOT episode, while it's been 2 hours since the Flash finished airing and I've already forgotten what happened. Indeed, focusing on the season's two most boring storylines, the metahuman cure and defeating Grace Kada, is a surefire way to render my interest in the show negligible. Add in some whirlwind Sherlock-Rene romance and it's a recipe for utter boredom. The cure storyline has been a bane on this season ever since it was introduced in the midseason premiere, and it being prominent in this episode didn't do the overarching story any favors. Having said that, it did give us the opportunity to see Joe step up slowly, hinting towards his eventual captaincy, and that was the only personal storyline that I liked. I loved his speech towards the scared Menas in the end, yes. Clearly, everyone should have listened to Ralph way ahead of time, because the rest of the team's tunnel vision about Grace Kada came to bite them in the end. Barry launched whatever that vaporizing device was called, and I presume that, even though we didn't see what happened, it vaporized the dagger, thereby releasing Thawne. Aggravating storytelling, to be quite honest, but Thawne's released now, so hopefully things will become marginally more interesting. We'll have to talk about that, because I literally don't know what happened. The Iron Heights Warden said that the red electrocuting lightning is what will kill Thawne, as that's what they're using to subdue him, and presumably to execute him. Indirect foreshadowing, perhaps, that Nora's foray into the negative speed force will be life-threatening, and we will see those repercussions next episode?
Or the opposite.
She will kill Thawne?
Well, with no, red lightning? About the red lightning destroying Thawne.
Oh, it'll actually become more powerful than ever.
Yeah. Yes.
Speaking of Nora.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. Or not, right. Spoilers, because I'm
spoilers. Prediction spoilers.
Yeah. Speaking of Nora, I'd have been more sympathetic towards her wanting agency to make her own decisions and making a case for herself if she hadn't been making bad and impulsive decisions all season. She uses the good old, I'm an adult, I can make my own decisions card, but it's kind of hard for that to hold any weight, given how we've seen her behave. While I presume Killer Frost and Nora, due to her connection to Grace, will be the ones to take Grace Gaeta down, it's difficult to see how Killer Frost is going to get the upper hand in any fight, given that Grace Gaeta is 2-0 at this point, and Killer Frost has twice been knocked the hell out. Hey, she was up for like a whole minute this week. I was so proud. Like, wow. This is the most fighting she's ever done. Barry, however, actually got back up and knocked Grace Gaeta out. I guess he learned something from his wife, the undefeated Iris West Allen. So hooray for that. I feel like that's the first this season. I'm sorry, Mara. I will be skipping a little bit. But The Flash 21. Hello, ladies. How are you doing? Wishing you a good weekend. We will make sure our weekend is better than our week has been. My feelings of this episode can be summed up in one typical plot four scene of the girl with the red lightning. After Barry somehow gets up to knock Grace out, shocking after he lays a pine on the ground while Killer Frost and Ralph got their not particularly productive days in the sun, and actually succeeds, he, Ralph, or Killer Frost, the latter of whom weren't doing anything at this point, didn't think to get up and cuff Grace. This is standard plot fare on The Flash, but it's especially grating given how tedious the previous 40 minutes of the episode had been. And to think that this is the penultimate episode of the season? No, honestly, I have to let that one sink in. 521 was easily the worst penultimate episode of any season of The Flash. And then she goes in to discuss the good points of the previous seasons that we can all remember because they were so much better than this one. And then there is 521, The Girl with the Red Lightning. I barely recall what happened in this episode, although I have a bone to pick with Nora, who acted rashly and impulsively this season, now suddenly wanting to make her own decisions and not be mollycoddled by her parents. Barry and Iris were relegated to worried parents this episode. What did they do besides stand around and give each other concerned looks, as Nora adamantly insisted she could help defeat Grace? Although I appreciate that West Allen are back to being supportive husband and wife duo, as whenever either one asserted Nora's safety, the other would unequivocally back them up. Nora, on the other hand, couldn't have expected her mom and dad to truly believe she could make her own decisions, but she got this arc this episode so that she can have her moment of heroism and in the finale. Okay. Sisko got to be his genius self this week, so at least there's that. And I somewhat relate to Sebastian Ollens. Yes, I do too. For I have nearly fallen asleep in physics lectures back when I was in the university. Ralph is finally making sense. The team should listen to him. Although while I'm sure fandom is going on about how smart Ralph is and how they should have heard about earlier, it grates me that even Ralph gets the credit he deserves. But Iris, who has used her investigative skills to discover Cicada's weakness, knocked out villains, and figured out why Ragdoll was targeting the victims he was, is still fighting for recognition, as certain people dismiss anything she does as unrealistic. But that's par for the course in this fandom. Yeah, we don't acknowledge those people. We already gave Iris the credit for for her earlier acts of intelligence in the season. And the people that don't just, you know, are booted out. It's clear for me the writing for The Flash began to become tired and repetitive in season 4. And it's no coincidence that this seemed to coincide with writers moving away from centering the story on Barry's trials and tribulations. Yes! That's what we've been saying. Yep.
Right.
At the end of the day, centering seasons on characters besides Barry has clearly hurt the show considerably. And one can hope that Crisis will force the writers to center the story on Barry. And thus West Allen and their shared trauma in the lead up to the crossover. Let us pray. Let us pray. All right. Another one. Okay. I had to find space to skip around in this one, too. But from Shaiwan. Yay! We heart you. We're approaching the end of the season. It's bittersweet. My first season interacting with the fandom has made season 5 very interesting. Well, that would make it very interesting for you. That's true. You've got a reason to be interested. Definitely some great moments of hearing other fans' thoughts and opinions about the episodes and the season. But, of course, some not-so-great moments. She liked the last podcast and Maya's thoughts. Unfortunately, last week was completely hectic, and I didn't have time to give more detailed thoughts on the episode. I enjoyed this week's episode. It had some good moments and some okay moments. I enjoyed the Joe storyline. Snaps for Joe! Captain Singh leaving him in charge of the craziness was great. We got to see Joe have a moment of panic and self-doubt before Cecile helped him realize that it was no different than what he's been doing for years, just on a larger scale. I'm thinking this is foreshadowing for Joe becoming the captain. Yep. Ooh, and maybe Singh becoming mayor. I like that. Singh becoming mayor. I like that.
As long as he doesn't die, I'm okay with it.
As long as he doesn't die. That's what I don't. We finally got the Nora we deserved, but it comes when she's about to disappear. Acting and sounding more like the age she's supposed to be and not the bratty teenager was great to see. I wasn't too surprised when the Grace connection was brought back into the mix. I enjoyed that. I didn't enjoy her temper tantrum in the hospital. That was a bit
cringe. That was stupid.
Yep. I loved Ralph this episode. We finally got someone asking the real questions about Thawne and that damn dagger. Barry and Iris are back to being Barry and Iris in terms of being on the same page when it comes to parenting. It's understandable to have pause about Nora's and her influence at this point, but we don't have to baby her again and again. Nora was actually sounding mature and made sense with her speech to Barry and Iris about being an adult. I'm glad she realizes it because she wasn't acting like one half the time during the season. I'm going to need the writers and producers of Flash to do a better job not making Barry look incompetent just to make other characters relevant. I'm tired of him taking L's so that Frost can have something to do. She's supposedly the key to stopping Cicada, but I've yet to see her do anything that would warrant that belief. She stood up for a full minute during a fight, okay?
Tanya was going to, like, beat this to death.
She is the key!
Killer Frost, the Skin Squad.
She'll stand and stare her down.
Oh, this is the second episode in a row that Cisco's life has been threatened, and I don't like that. I enjoyed seeing him this episode, though. It reminded me that if he's leaving the show and this send-off, I'm not going to be happy because we have one episode left, and there is no hint in the storyline in the back half that would have us believing he's leaving after the next episode. There is no build-up. I agree. So he better not be leaving. He better stay. Finally, the Thawne plot with the dagger. He's been playing chess the entire time, moving everyone into position so that he can escape his imprisonment. Yes, he is a planner, and he's shown that he's willing to wait 15 years for his plan to come together. It looks like he's done it again, waited another 15 years for another one of his plans. You have to be a special kind of evil for that. We all knew Barry was right. Thawne can't be trusted, and we finally see the extent of his manipulation of Nora. I'm sure he cares about her, just like he cared about Barry and Cisco, but that didn't stop him from doing what he did in season one. Thawne will always be about Thawne. Thank you, Shywan!
If I had my wish, everything would be wrapped up by 8:30, and the rest of the episode would just be them doing character stuff.
Imagine. I would love that, but no. Sadly, that is probably not going to be the case. But now that we have done our feedback, we've got Supergirl and Arrow on side A, The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, and Doom Patrol on side B. As always, we will do our likes, our dislikes, and Lady with Gumption of the Week. So May will set us off with side A, Indelible Marks / Clean Slate.
All right, starting off with Supergirl, Miss Tessmacher returns with a vengeance. Kara and Lena head to Kasnia to hunt down Lex. However, Eve Tessmacher sets a trap for the duo that could ultimately reveal that Kara is Supergirl. Meanwhile, Alex gets a long-awaited phone call, James practices using his powers, and Ben Lockwood takes a dangerous stand inside the DEO. Shannon Coley directed the episode with story by Derek Simon and teleplay by Katie Rose Rogers and Natalie Abrams. Oh, okay, so Natalie co-wrote the episode, I see.
Yes.
What did we like about this episode?
Well, I guess, like, working backwards from the least interesting plot to the most interesting, the least interesting being the Lockwood plot with Brainy Nia and James. I did like the little training session between the three of them. I thought Brainia's excitement and curiosity over eagerness to test James's powers contrasted with James being, like, so cautious and his skepticism made for a really good scene dynamic. And then my favorite part was Nia saying, like, hammer time and chasing James while he shouted, not the face! I love that. I thought that was really funny. And then, like, you know, like, them just setting him on fire and, like, doing all this, like, crazy stuff. Also, I have to say props to George. I have to apologize because I didn't think that, you know, his turnaround was going to be legit. But it turns out his heart really did grow two sizes last week. I'm glad it wasn't a fake out because he placed his anger over his mother's death in the right direction, which was at his father. I'm glad he recognized that his mother wasn't murdered because aliens were bad. She was murdered because his racist father and xenophobic father engineered, like, an untenable situation between aliens and humans in which aliens don't feel like they can live their lives without being harassed, and they've been pushed into this corner that makes everything very dangerous in this kind of pressure cooker kind of situation. So I'm glad that the blame was put in the right direction and didn't send George back down a dark path. With Alex and Kelly, I thought they also had a pretty powerful, if not contained, storyline. I love that Alex and Kelly are already doing things, like, domestic things together, like going for runs and comparing notes on their jobs and complaining about getting old and all this kind of stuff. I liked that Kelly stayed with Alex, calmed her fears about the whole adoption process, and even went so far as to travel with her and stay with her while Alex's potential baby is born. And it just shows how much of a caring heart Kelly has. And that also kind of makes me a little bit sad that this whole misunderstanding between her and her brother kept them apart for like 20 plus years. Because we could have been getting this kind of relationship between Kelly and James and just Kelly in general on the show a lot earlier, if not for this strained relationship. Alex got so much free therapy in this episode, pouring out her heart to Kelly, which was, it's kind of funny. It was like, it was a good storyline. It was kind of funny. Like, she's not getting billed at all for this. Like, it's nice having a girlfriend that is a therapist. I called the young mom reneging on the adoption the moment the baby was born. I thought that was pretty much of an obvious plot point from the start. So my heart really went out to Alex for having to go through this like full roller coaster of emotions in a span of 12 hours. When she hadn't really even been getting any kind of feedback since for like over a year, she said. And I thought it was like a good way to kind of delicately show the long, kind of lengthy and sometimes painful process a lot of people go through when they do decide to adopt. Like, it's not as simple as saying, I want a child and here you go. So this episode really made me think that the writers are going to take their time with the storyline. It seemed like they had been like neglecting it for forever, but it does feel like in this episode that the way that they reintroduce the storyline and how they've included Kelly into it makes me think that they're going to continue to explore the depth of this process, and that Kelly will be around to be a part of that. And I also appreciated the natural, quote unquote, natural way they worked into the episode with both Alex and Kelly confirming to each other that they're gay. Like Alex, yeah,
that was so
Alex,
funny. Like,
bringing up the fact that her fiance Maggie, they broke up because she didn't want kids, and then later Kelly is like casually bringing up being in love with her sergeant, which could be male or female, and how hard it was for them because they couldn't openly date while abroad, which again could be interpreted as because, you know, either sexuality or because she's dating her superior, you don't know. And then Kelly's like, and then she died. I'm like, yeah. It's kind of weird. Like, it's a very tragic story, but like, yeah, she died. So like, nicely played writers.
And
threading that in there. She's like, oh, so you're saying I have a chance. Yes. Anyways. And then finally, the most interesting plot was, of course, like Kasnia and Supercore storyline with Kara kind of like navigating dangerous situation after a more increasingly dangerous situation to avoid telling Lena that she's Supergirl. I think it's always like hilarious to me when Kara has to pretend to be saved by other people. Like last week, I think it was like Carl and Katko. She's like, you saved me. What was his name? She's like, you saved me. And then like this week, you know, I had like her pretending to be passed out and playing with her glasses askew. It was just like hilarious because of how ridiculous she looked. But I also have like a lot more on that later. So save that. Coming back, save that. Put a, like a little bookmark right there. I do like that they have confirmed the existence of Red Daughter and Lex's plans to overthrow the government, and the debate that she and Lena have of nature versus nurture of Red Daughter. And I like that Kara, obviously knowing that Red Daughter is her clone, has faith that deep down that she's inherently good and that she can be convinced to change. Eve Testmacher using Copy's powers to trick install Supercore while the bomb timer on the building was running out was pretty smart, even if Supercore themselves were kind of dumb enough to not notice something was clearly not right with this Eve. Like, you just read the exposition reminding the audience who Copy was. How do you not recognize that something is wrong, ladies? Like, come on. Despite that, I thought Kara and Lena worked really great as a team. There's so much Supercore angst throughout the storyline with regards to them questioning Eve. I like Lena's bad cop to Kara's good cop. I liked how much Lena tried to take the lead to protect Kara, and all the kind of like the close calls that they had, and how Kara was upset and like devastated for the split second that she thought Kara had died in the explosion because she was too late to save her friend, because that's just the kind of person that Lena is. I loved the tension between Lena and Eve and how it came to the head on Lena's plane and the fight between them, and later, like, how Eve's betrayal of Lena feels fully fleshed out, and how Lena explains afterward to Kara how much that friendship meant to her and what it means for her to lose that kind of trust. I think it really sets up the situation for a beautiful fallout when Lena finally does realize that Kara is Supergirl. So, nothing else. I'm excited for that.
Overall, I liked the episode. I really liked how Alex was able to share that a difficult and life-changing experience with Kelly, and how Kelly was there for her throughout, and they really bonded very easily and deeply over it. So it shows how well-suited they are to each other, and definitely opens the door for a future relationship between them. And yes, the moments where they, you know, gave their sexuality away in casual conversation were great, especially when Kelly was saying she, because Alex's eyes were like, oh, I can't get excited about this. This is not a good time. But yes. So I loved that. I think it's, like you said, it really shows how much, like, what a great person Kelly is, and how much she has to give for people, how much she can help James, and now how much she can help Alex. But at the same time, I like that Kelly was allowed to open up about her own past as well. It wasn't just her being there to support Alex's storyline, both this time and last week, I guess it was, when she went into James's mind, there was part of it that was there for her, right? For her to either resolve the issue she had with her brother last week, and then this week for her to be able to open up about her past relationship that no one else, or that not many people even know about. So they were both able to be there for each other in that way. I liked that. Also, I liked the little, like, brainy Nia James team up. I thought that they were a lot of fun. I liked the training session in the beginning, and then also I liked them all fighting Ben and his peeps at the end, and it's like the way that they did it, like, it made it feel like they've been a team, like, forever, right? So I was like, I like that. It seems like you see, this is one way where it's like showing you how the friendships have evolved and not just telling you. Like, a couple episodes ago, or not a couple, but there was a time when Brainy was like, James and I have coffee every day or something, and we're like, do you? That sounds very fictional. So now, but this is like, we see it in action, and I like that. Also, I loved when Brainy, like, you know, stood up to Lockwood and refused to follow orders, and then also convinced the, like, DO, FBI, whoever agents to do the same, right? Like, follow your hearts and not orders, and I like that. And I think that, like, the last couple episodes have had Brainy sort of, like, calculating odds, and, like, just, like, now that he's, like, very much in the line of danger, like, not even in his own time, it's understandable that he's gotten a little more risk-averse as an android that he is, but I love how he's just, like, every time he's proving himself to be more heroic than before. So, yay, Brainy. Also, speaking of standing up to authority, George telling his dad that he's a piece of shit was very cathartic. I'm very proud of him. And I also have to apologize, like Jessica, because we did not expect this at all. We definitely thought he was going to go the aliens did this route. But instead, he was like, no one would have done this if my dad hadn't spread lies and hate and fear. So, 4 for you, George. Also, I like that he was, like, observant enough to see his father leaving his mother's funeral, like, in the middle of a speech, and then to connect that to, like, my dad doesn't really care about us. He cares about his own little vengeance plot.
Right.
Like, what kind of person would do that, right? So, yeah, I like that. Kara and Lena heading to Kasnia. It was like, there was a lot of fun, a lot of peak comedy, as Shang has said, and as Jessica pointed out. But I also really liked the girls rediscovering the puzzle pieces of the plot, or them discovering it for the first time, and then the audience sort of, like, rediscovering it along with them. Like, yeah, that is what's happening. Yay, they're figuring it out. All of that. If I turn my brain off, then I really like all the close calls that Kara had to go through, and, like, you know, putting on the glasses, taking off the glasses, having to wait until the absolute last second to save the plane, pretending like she forgot her tape recorder so she can go.
And, like, you saw, like, Lena's face, like, what? Tape recorder?
Yeah.
You know, like, you're going back for a tape recorder? And then, like, later when she actually, like, has, like, Lena's, like, Kara's tape recorder, and, right. That's what's and up, was, like, yeah.
Yeah, just like, thank you, Kara. Good thing you forgot. You went back for this. Good thing
you forgot, aka yeah. I stole it somehow.
Yeah. So, so yeah, I like that. I also thought that Clone Eve, or what, Copy Eve, I guess, was really funny. and also the fact that they couldn't tell that she was clearly a copy was also very funny. So yeah, overall, I enjoyed the episode.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I still like that Kara is doing a lot of investigating, like cutting her off from the DEO and from publicly being Supergirl has done wonders for this show. Flash should take notes. So I enjoyed all of that stuff in Kaznia of the team up between her and Lena and all of that going through the mystery and figuring stuff out. And then Kara seeing the wall of her doppelganger and figuring out that it was Harrenell that split them. And basically, you know, this is as close to me getting really excited about a, like, Kara versus Kara showdown. And I really like that Brainy got a chance to really step up this episode and how he tried to stand against Lockwood at every chance he got. And then I think he's come a long way in terms of character development, because before he wouldn't have been able to do that. And then him and Nia testing out James's powers was really sweet. And I especially love that James called Nia kiddo. They seem to have a very easygoing camaraderie, and I like that. I'd like to see more of that. I enjoyed Alex's storyline very much for the most part. I feel like she got a chance to show how freaked out she was about being a mom so soon, even though it's what she's wanted all along. But that fear and being open and being honest and vulnerable that she got to be with Kelly was really good, because those are all feelings that people go through. It's not just like, oh, I'm going to be a mom. This is the most happiest day of my life. That's not usually how it works. And it speaks to how much she trusts Kelly that she got to open up about Maggie. And then I was worried that Kelly would just be supporting Alex with her journey, but she also got to open up about her fiance and the pain that she went through after her death. And then also the confirmation that she was married to a woman, or she was with a woman, was nicely done. And I echo Tati, Alex momentary like surprise look and the hope in her eyes was not on me. So like, make your move, Alex. And then finally, I really liked that George also realized that his dad was a shithead and told him off. Liked it even more that our fears of him blaming the whole alien population for his mom's death didn't happen. And that he finally saw the light when it came to his dad and how at fault he is for starting all of this on a massive scale. Yeah. So what are we not like?
Well, before I start my TED Talk, the minor things first. I think we got like an anon on Tumblr. It's like, am I the only one that thinks that Kara not telling Lena that she's Supergirl has put Lena's life at risk? And like, listen, you are not the only one. And you will come to my TED Talk. You are invited to my TED Talk this afternoon, in which I will discuss all the ways why Kara should have told Lena. But anyway, minor things first. I didn't like really much of the, I don't know, I guess it was a C plot line, the Ben Lockwood storyline.
Right.
It was like the least interesting thing to me. I thought Brainy seemed a little bit overwhelmed in trying to stop Lockwood on his own without having Kaylee there, without having Alex there. A lot of it was put on him. And I think just Lockwood just being there and being as like deranged and upset and angry as he was, it, like, Brainy didn't seem to know how to kind of handle it. And so I felt bad for Brainy. I don't like that Lockwood has powers now. I hope they killed him. Like, because he said, like, Brainy said that he's taking like the untested or the raw version of the drug, and so I hope that's what kills him, honestly. Like, his greed and his for like power and his hatred, I really do hope it kills him in the end. Yes, so that's that on that. While I loved Alex and Kelly spending so much time together again, I have to stress that I would like to see them bond over something other than trauma, please and thank you. Can we do that next week? You know, like, her brother's not dying. Alex is not stressing out over baby. Just like, have some more fun things for them to do. Now, I will say in the Cosmia storyline that I thought that Melissa was really great acting wise. I echo like what you guys said about, you know, her finding the Linda's room and all of the pictures of her and Lena and the panic on her face. I thought that was really well acted, but I spent much of the episode and of the plot line thinking about how much easier this Kazian mission would have been if Kara had just told Lena she was Supergirl. And I really felt kind of annoyed. Like, as good as, like, those near misses and moments are, I felt annoyed by Kara in the sense that she put Lena and herself in unnecessary danger by handicapping herself, by hiding her powers, not using them or using them covertly at the last second. And, like, as hilariously ridiculous as it is to watch Kara damsel herself for Lena's benefit, like, imagine how Lena is going to feel when she finds out that Kara could have saved and probably has been saving them this whole time. I personally would feel like an idiot, or like Kara is treating me like an idiot or a fool, letting me do all this stuff when she could have just fixed the situation in a fraction of the time. Like, getting, like, first of all, let's get one thing clear. Lena's life has always been at risk. She's always been in danger because she's a Luther, not because Kara is Supergirl. Like, it's not a Flash situation where Barry's like, oh my God, Iris is going to be in so much more trouble if they know that I love her. Like, Lena's always had that in her life. Like, being a Luther, having your life in danger is not nothing new to her. So that's not really a good reason why Kara couldn't tell her that she was Supergirl. And then on top of that, Lena is carrying around, because Lena's like had this her whole life, she's carrying around all of this guilt and responsibility of protecting her poor, innocent, defenseless friend, Kara, who's ended up in some pretty like dangerous life-threatening situations because of the Luther family curse. Like, Lena's holding like all of this guilt on her shoulders because she thinks that she has to protect Kara from the mess that she involved Kara in. Like, think about all the times that Lena has had to like woman up to protect her best friend, her first real kind of connection that she's had with somebody in National City, someone that has opened up to her, trusted her with her life, believed in her despite her family's past, all of this kind of stuff. So she feels so much responsibility in her friendship with Kara and protecting that. And it's the same with James and their relationship. And like Lena's desperation to not only keep her relationship with James together in the beginning, but also like her desperation to like not only preserve that relationship, but also save James's life because of this whole thing that this is something that is special to her. And she's trying to keep it as much as possible because it's not something that she is used to having in her life. And then, so you think about all of that, and then you find out that the friend that you thought trusted you and you put all of your, you know, your time into building this relationship, and your friend didn't trust you enough to tell you this huge ass secret of her life. And then you consider the fact that it's not just that Kara is Supergirl, but you also have to throw in the whole Superman Lex Luthor aspect of it all. And I think that really hurt a lot more, because it's just one more thing to compare to, oh, not only did you not trust me, but you didn't trust me because I was a Luther, because of the history with your cousin and my brother. So it's just all of that is just like percolating and becoming more potent and potent as like the episode goes on, like this whole the black cloud of Lena finding out that she's Supergirl. Kara has had like so many opportunities to tell Lena in this episode, starting from that lightning storm on the plane, and then the military building when it's literally on fire and exploding around them. And rather than escape, Kara's like, Kara, the human journalist, has to go back for reasons, quote unquote, that she lost a tape recorder. Like, just, you know, you're in a burning building, it's about to explode. Who goes back for a tape recorder? I thought that was like peak ridiculousness and kind of like, I think Lena is just like a tape recorder, like why are you going back for that, like you're about to die. And now like the way that the episode ended is she's waited too long, because when you think about, you know, when she's about to reveal herself and then she's listening to Lena's speech on Eve's betrayal and how impossible it is for her to gain that trust back with Eve, and now it's just like impossible for Kara to even reveal herself and not have it blow up badly. And I feel like, honestly, if she wanted to avoid the fallout of this whole situation, the best time to tell Lena would have been, like, in the middle of one of the many crises they had on this trip. Because, like, how can you get mad when you're about to... I know this is horrible timing, but we're about to die, so I can save us because I'm Supergirl. I know it's shocking, and you can be mad about it later, but after I save you. But right now, we still need to work together. Like, I feel like they could have done that. Like, even, like, if on the plane, in the light, with, like, first kind of crisis that they went into in the lightning storm, if Kara had revealed that she was Supergirl, then they could have spent like a lot of the Kazian inside the prison, like, arguing or, you know, discussing about why you lied to me, but then that would be on the back burner because they're also, like, about to die, and then after they have to work together, then maybe, like, Lena wouldn't be as mad, but you can't even do that now because she waited too long. And so whatever comes in this storm that's about to come, it's on Kara because she should have told her a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And then, like, finally, at the end, when she goes to President Baker, I thought it was just really naive of her of not to notice that the president was shady. Like, when the president tells you, you hand this, like, treasonous document over that the president's secretary is, you know, colluding with the Kazian government, and the president's first question is, did you tell anybody else? That is red flag.
Right.
Number 1 through 10, that this is shady. And so, I don't know, maybe she was just, like, distracted because of the fact that she didn't get to tell Lena, and that's another reason why she should have told Lena in the first place. But I thought it was just dumb that she got kidnapped at the end. It was stupid. Anyways.
Yeah, when my brain is off, or when my brain is back on, because when my brain's off, I'm fine with it. But when my brain's back on, I did not enjoy the Kara and Lena shenanigans because I'm just mostly not understanding why Kara wouldn't tell Lena. Like Jessica already explained very in depth, Lena has already lived her life under, like, the microscope because she is a Luther. She's already been in danger because of who she knows. She feels guilty because she puts the people she loves in danger. And so knowing all of this about Lena, which Kara has known since the day that she met her, I don't understand why that would be a person that she thinks shouldn't know, especially when literally everyone else in her life knows.
Alex Nia had just got here and Nia knows.
Yes. Alex had to unknow, and that hurts Kara actively. Alex not knowing has been a plot point for Kara in several episodes where she's like, I just makes me feel like my sister doesn't know me because she doesn't know the side of me that she's always known. So I'm like, how can you feel, like, complete in your friendship with Lena then? Like, shouldn't you also feel like Lena doesn't know you? Like, this just seems like you don't really care about Lena that much if you're not concerned about the fact that Lena doesn't know you. So, yeah. I know that Kara cares about Lena, and Shang very beautifully described the moments where you see that Kara cares about Lena, but it does not make logical sense with the rest of her personality, which is like, hello, friend. Welcome to my Chamber of Secrets. This is... this is my Fortress of Solitude, and this is where, or whatever I call this one, my Fortress of Happiness and Rainbows. And it is because I am Supergirl. So, I don't know. I really hate it. It just, it makes the relationship feel really imbalanced or unbalanced. And yeah, she spent like 3 seasons now not experiencing any kind of dissonance over Lena not knowing the truth. Like, Lena's brother and her mother both know. And they're both like, what if I told Lena? And Kara's like, oh, no. And then, like, 2 minutes later, nothing has changed. She has not done anything to try to prevent Lena from finding out at any given moment from her psychotic brother and mother, who could use this information to blackmail Supergirl/Kara. Because Supergirl/Kara doesn't really care if Lena knows or not, apparently. Okay. I also didn't, like, I thought this episode was well written. In the ways that they had these moments crop up naturally, where Kara could tell Lena in that moment, or, you know, go save the day. It's not really an or, she could do both. But, like, it's like, oh, it's so heightened that she just gives up in that moment and just goes to save the day, right? And then she thinks she's going to have another chance. And she does, just the same thing. And then finally she's going to tell her, oh, no, it's too late now because Lena just said the thing about how it would be horrible, right? But, like, of course... it's great in this episode, but it just angers me because she's had these moments for 3 years. You know, she's been postponing it, I guess, for 3 years. And the show has never cared about bringing it up until now, just because they're setting up that Lena has now said, it's too late to tell me. And next week, presumably, she's going to find out the truth from someone else. So it feels similar to the thing that I didn't like about the Alex storyline, which is... that it's been 20 episodes since we heard about Alex wanting to be a mother and the adoption papers. And now suddenly they're like, the adoption is a thing. And it's been weighing on Alex's mind. And we've set it up just so that she can lose it at the end of this episode. And again, it was written really well in this episode. But before that, it was like, not a thing. People forgot that it was a thing until it showed up in the previously. Also, the fact that Kara was like not available at all. Like, they couldn't even just be like, oh, that's so great. I'm really excited for you. However, I have to go to Casnia now. Talk to you later, kind of thing. Just so that, like, I'm happy that she's able to rely on Kelly, but it was weird that they had to, like, bring that up. Like, oh, I can't talk to Kara, so I have to talk to Kelly. I was like, okay. But yeah. Also, it, like, adds to, like, a feeling of estrangement for me between Kara and Alex, which I guess, like, makes sense because Alex doesn't know the truth about Kara, but because that wasn't really the point in this episode, it felt kind of weird. It felt like it was, like, not supposed to be there. I didn't like the copy part where, like, again, like, copy is just there so that we can look at it and be like, oh, copy was like this, this, and this. And I remember because I fought them recently. Here is a copy, but I don't recall the things that I just said to realize that this is a copy. So that was, like, a little bit silly, but I wasn't, like, mad about it. I just thought that it made Kara and Lena look like they have short-term memory loss. And, yeah, I mean, I don't even remember the parts of the Lockwood plot, aside from, like, I was concerned for Brainy's safety, but then Brainy was awesome, so I wasn't anymore. But, yeah, I'm sure that I thought that it was stupid. And that Kara looked dumb when she believed the president was on the right side. I mean, to begin with, the president has clearly been on the opposite side, the side of evil, from, like, episode 2, from the moment that, like, they kicked out the Wonder Woman and replaced her with this dude. So I don't know why Kara or Supergirl would have come to him at all. Like,
he gave Lockwood a job. Like, why would you think that he's legit?
Exactly. Like, I don't know. I feel like if she felt like he needed to be protected, she could have done it in a different way without, like, bringing herself over there and providing, like, the one copy of very top secret information to him, etc. Like, not a good plan.
And the fact that Kara told the truth that she only had one copy and that she was giving it to him was just dumb. Pretend like you made copies and sent them. I hope that she was lying and that she's just like.
That's what I was gonna say. Dumb. Hopefully she was lying about that. But we'll know next week. I'll say we may never know. We will know next week, which is the finale, right? The finale is next week. And by next week, I mean
two Sundays.
Two Sundays? Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. This is episode 20. So there's 2 episodes left. Okay. Yeah. Never mind. All right. So that's my dislikes.
All right. Yeah. What frustrated me the most was definitely the Casnian plot, but that's primarily due to Kara having 3 different opportunities to tell Lena her secret and not taking them. And the show keeps trying to make Kara look sympathetic for not telling Lena, and also making it so Lena will eventually find out by accident. You know, it's for once I wanted to see a hero take ownership over their secret instead of waiting for the eventual reveal and fallout. Like, Lena's an adult and would have been more than able to handle the truth, even though she'll be mad about it. And then Kara deciding to keep the secret is still only protecting herself. So I really don't like that the moment Kara does actually decide to tell Lena the truth, she finds a reason not to, and it made me more mad that she has to keep making Lena look dumb, and that she also has to kind of play, like, the damsel in distress around her just to continue hiding it. Like, it's cute with other people, but it's not cute with Lena, because we're going... Because
there's an actual, like, relationship there.
Exactly.
Like, Carl, or whatever his name is, at Catco, like, that you see maybe once in 10 episodes, fine. But, like, this, like, person that you have a relationship with, and knowing Lena, and, like, what friendship means to Lena, it just makes Kara seem a little bit ridiculous.
Exactly. And like you ladies already said, everyone already knows. So, of course, her best friend doesn't know, which is ridiculous. And that will never not be disappointing and exhausting at this point, because it's already dragged on for, like, this is going to be the end of a 3rd season where she doesn't know that Kara is Supergirl. And I think this is, like, the longest of any of the other shows that have gone on with the secret. So it's really, really bad. And then as soon as Eve started glitching the first time, they should have realized what was happening. Like Tati said, they were aware copy was there, or they read about it or whatever. So maybe use your own logic. I don't know. And then I know that Kara always wants to do good, but I think the writers need to start drawing lines between being a good person and being a naive person. And Kara going to the president with the original file without having made copies, or so we assume she hasn't made copies, or, like, having a draft written about all the information she found and publishing it, was not a good move. This is the president who deputized the Children of Liberty and made Lockwood the member of his staff. So, like, why would he have the country's best interests at heart? So I think she should have been a bit more suspicious of him before handing him the documents about Lex and Casio. And then minor nitpick, but Guardian is back on the streets protecting people without much consequence. But I can't remember if I missed something or if this is just the show forgot that he was.
I feel like it was a Lockwood thing. Like, Lockwood was like, he's an American hero. And so they're like, okay, then we won't arrest him or something like that. This is back when James was in his dumb days and thinking that
I almost forgot there are good
people on both sides.
Yeah.
This is when James was on his bullshit.
And finally, I agree about the subplot about Alex wanting to be a mother. It was like pushed aside for so long that I would have appreciated it more if it hadn't been dumped into one episode and so late in the season. Like, the hope and then the disappointment was a lot to take emotionally because everything happened so fast. And I know that adoption process takes very long, but I think that they could have had her on the phone occasionally or looking at the website longingly. I don't know. I think it would have been better had they sprinkled the updates of her adopting throughout several episodes instead of up and forgetting about it until now. And now moving on into predictions. What do we predict will happen in the next two episodes?
Like, well, I basically said mine that I really hope that Kara was faking it, because obviously in the preview she escapes pretty quickly because you see her as Supergirl confronting Linda Lee. But then, like, she put herself in a situation that she can't get out of unless she's Supergirl. And then the president knows that she's Supergirl. And that's just one other person that knows before Lena knows. So, yeah, I also think, you know, of course, that Lena is going to find out by, you know, not Kara, that she is Supergirl, whether it's through Red Daughter or Lex or somebody else. And it's going to set up, I think they'll probably be like the cliffhanger that sets up the entire season 5 going into Crisis. Angst away.
I like the angst. I like it. And I agree with it.
I feel like I had a prediction and I can't remember what it was, so we're moving into Arrow. Oliver is put to the test, a moral test, because he wants to play judge, jury, and executioner. So he finds himself in a precarious position. SCPD shows up with a warrant for Felicity. And that's all. He is stuck under a torn, explosive building the entire episode, and he has a concussion, and he sees Tommy in his concussion, or his muddled brain, in which he's basically talking to himself about wanting to kill Emiko while the team tries to get out. And in the future, William finally gets mad at Felicity. Gordon Verhul, I think that's how you say his name, I'm sorry, directed the episode written by Oscar Balderrama and Sarah Tarkoff. What did we like?
I liked having Tommy back. I think Colin Donnell's great. I always like having him back. And I think that Tommy is a good way of highlighting both how far Oliver has come from season one and also how he's still stuck in the same place. And he was stuck in one place all episode. So, you know, great. I love metaphors. Okay. I also liked that Tommy's hallucination was, like, a lot harsher and, like, more straightforward than actual Tommy. Because it's really just a Oliver's subconscious bashing him. So, yes, it was cathartic. And I've been saying cathartic a lot today. And, like, super frustrating to have Tommy give voice to both Oliver and the show's issues, right, of repeating the same patterns over and over again. Especially because there's only, like, one half of a season left in the show, and we already know that in the end, Oliver will fail his city at least short term before his death. So it's like bittersweet, I guess. I think they set up Felicity's departure the best that they possibly can, and that having Alina, or Elena, however you say her name, be the one that makes Felicity realize that she would have to disappear to protect her kid was, you know, pretty interesting. I feel like Elena is the person who would come in and think that, have a different perspective, because she's not used to this constant, you know, struggle life. So I also like that we're getting to see the flash forwards, the Galaxy One storyline, because it sort of gives a full circle to Felicity's plot, since we know we're not going to have her back in any like full capacity next season. It makes sense for them to show her kind of finishing what she started. Even if it took like 20 years, she does still come back around and help Star City do whatever Star City is going to do in the finale.
I would agree with that. I liked having Tommy back this episode, and the what do you call it? I guess the pattern that the show has been using of bringing right. back very popular characters in these kind of dream sequences for Oliver, and having them have some kind of, having that be a metaphor for whatever lesson Oliver needs to learn. And I agree with Tati about how, particularly in this situation with Tommy being back, that it was a great way to once again come full circle from season one to show how some things have changed, but also how some things have stayed the same. And it does kind of remind of the Prometheus episode where he was hallucinating Prometheus. And but instead, in this episode, he doesn't need advice on being like a murderer, but he does need advice on family and what that means to stick by family versus giving up on family. And so it was good that Tommy was kind of like the Jiminy Cricket or the good angel in this episode, trying to get Oliver to see past the cycle of violence that Oliver's threatening to fall back into, with regards to his sister Emiko betraying him and him giving up on her. So I liked Tommy's role in Oliver's kind of dilemma. And I also liked that largely most of this episode was a hallucination, and that you don't really realize the depth of the hallucination until the climax of the episode. Because a lot of, if it was not, a lot of it would have been like for real in my dislikes. So I'll go into that later. But I do like that it turned out to be an hallucination and that Oliver is not as dumb as he appeared to be. And then I also agree with the Felicity sentiments about, you know, her. It makes sense that you're getting to see so much of her arc and the closure of her arc in this season because she won't be around next season. And them kind of finishing what they started 20 years in the future. And how both of those, like the beginning of the Galaxy One arc and the end of the Galaxy One arc, are kind of happening at the same time. So that's cool.
I did like that William finally got to be mad at Felicity after 84 years of not being able to be mad. He finally got to like let it all out and, you know, talk about his feelings, which was great. So yay, William, because you deserve that, because I like adult William a lot and I want him to have that relief. I also liked the fact that Oliver hallucinated Tommy, because I also like seeing him back. I think he was killed off too early, and I think that having him be in Oliver's head, as technically he was Oliver because he was like harsher or whatever, he was his brain talking to him, but I appreciated the fact that someone was, you know, there to kind of knock some sense into him, even though that sense should have already been there to begin with. I also agree about the future Felicity storyline and how that is kind of, I can't believe it's even being wrapped up. Like, I'm thinking about next week and I'm thinking it's her last episode and I can't even believe that right now. But it is her last episode, and I think that they've been doing a good job kind of giving her a full circle storyline regarding, you know, her family, regarding her job, regarding everything that she wanted to do that they never really did for her in previous seasons. So I'm glad that she finally got that. I'm trying to think of anything else that I liked. I think those were the main things, because the rest of it kind of frustrated me. So on to what we didn't like.
Yeah, I think overall it felt like kind of a frustrating episode. At least for me, the fact that it took place primarily in Oliver's mind one episode before the finale just suggests that there's like not that much going on
in his
for the finale.
No, in the finale.
Like, I mean, like, okay, if you could spend 30 of the 40 minutes of the episode with Oliver talking to Tommy in his head, then it's kind of like, what were you really setting up? Even though we have a whole like 20 years later storyline, and presumably the Ninth Circle and Emiko are like this like global scale threat, but all of that can be wrapped up in one episode just fine somehow. Or maybe it won't be wrapped up in one episode. Maybe Emiko will be like a cliffhanger for next season, but we have to assume that the galaxy threat is going to be wrapped up because Felicity won't be back. either she dies in the finale or it's wrapped up. but anyway. So aside from that, I liked the conclusion that Oliver and kind of Tommy came to. And, you know, they're like, farewell. I'm like, I forgive you for constantly going back on to your old habits. Situation is like very, very sweet. I still think the fact that we had to talk Oliver out of killing Emiko to begin with is stupid. Like, okay, if he wants to be a killer, then he can be a killer. I don't really care about his immortal soul. So, like, if he wants to murder bad guys, then be my guest. But considering that he's gone through so much to move past killing people, and also to, like, be, like, he was so adamant about, like, doing the right thing after he got out of jail and, like, wanting to work with the cops and wanting to help the city in a productive way, realizing that it hasn't been that productive yet, I don't understand how he just flips back to not just murder, but also, like, killing his actual sister, because I guess of the reveal about their dad or whatever. I don't know. I don't really know what flipped the switch.
Because, like, she murdered or, like, was an accessory to murder to her father because she didn't tell him at the boat or something.
Yeah.
Is why he's mad, which you don't even like your father anyway, so. Whatever.
The season's best villain was Stan, so whatever.
This is accurate. But yeah, it was just like a really weird flip for me. And then also just like, it's like he covered up one bloodless killing from the cops, and now he's like, well, I guess I'll just go to massacre spree before I get locked up again, because I already did something illegal. So whatever. I don't know. I'm just not convinced. Also, the vision of everyone dying when he tries to kill Emiko, because like, oh, cycles of violence, you know, blood begets more blood or whatever. Like, it makes sense, but it's basically saying that he's not going to kill Emiko because he doesn't want to lose his friends, right? Well, I don't want everyone to die, so I won't kill Emiko. As opposed to just like, you're right, it would be very weird of me to kill my sister. I guess I'll stop. So yeah. And then meanwhile, Oliver and Felicity are making all these choices, like, for their kids, to protect their kids. But we already see that these choices mess up their kids' lives. And not just, like, their kids, but, like, all the kids. Like, Mia has to live in isolation, like, weird isolation with her mom until she finds out her mom's lying to her, and then she goes on her stupid rebellious spree when she finds out the truth. And William grew up believing his parents, like, abandoned him, and then just having, like, constant commitment issues because of it. And then Connor and JJ both hate their parents, and JJ was trying to kill Connor for some reason with his weird gang. And then there's Zoe, who's, like, the only well-adjusted one, but her dad almost blew up the city. So it's really not great. Nothing is looking good 20 years later, and I hate it. That's it.
Yeah. Like I said in my likes, that thank God this whole thing was a hallucination, because I was going to burn the writer's room down if Oliver escaped that building thinking that killing his own sister was the way to go, was the right thing to do. It felt like most of the episode screamed of old school, you know nothing, Oliver Queen. And like, he's just so like fucking hard-headed and stubborn. He's the most stubborn hero in the Arrowverse, and like, I just wanted, like, at some point I wanted, like, the rest of the building to just hurry up and collapse because I was tired of his shit. And the fact that he just wasn't listening to Tommy, and that he was being so hard-headed about it. And I was really annoyed when his, like, let me shoot explosives in an unstable building plan to escape actually worked. Like, I was really annoyed when like the ceiling fell down in a perfect circle and revealed his escape route. So hooray that it was all part of the hallucination and that he was actually still stuck underneath the building where he started. I didn't think he should have been rewarded for stupidity, so I was like glad when it turned out not to be the case. But in the moment, I was definitely heated for a lot of the episode. And I think for like the same reasons that you said, you know, the whole to kill or not to kill Emiko kind of situation. And the fact that it all kind of hinged on the fact that she didn't tell his father about the gambit, plans for the gambit to go down. And he's not even mad. Like, there, it'd be one thing if he was mad that she didn't tell him because his life was ruined by that night. Like, he's mad. Like, I think they made him mad about the wrong thing because he's, like, upset about his father died. But, like, he spent most of the season upset about all the mistakes that his father had made and wanting to not be like his father and, you know, not liking his father for the way that his father treated Emiko and abandoned her and all this kind of stuff. So why in that moment make him upset that she was responsible for his father's murder instead of her being responsible for placing him on the path to Lian Yu and all of the shit that he had to endure because of something that she did, or something that she didn't tell him, because like their dad was not the only one on that boat. He was on that boat as well. So I didn't like that how they framed his anger around a person that he didn't even really hold in that high of regard, instead of making it be like truly full circle and be about, this was the moment that dramatically altered my life and you're responsible for it. So I feel like that would have been a better way to go than what they did in this episode. I was really frustrated for a large part of the episode, and then the fact that he got out and just went through the entire exercise of actually killing Emiko, and then, like you said, the only thing that was flipped the light switch in his mind was his team being dead. Like, killing Emiko wasn't the thing to show him that, you know, you're going down the wrong path. It's just like, oh, I don't want all of my friends to die. I just want this one person to die, but I can't do that because everyone's going to die. So maybe I shouldn't do that. Like, it kind of seemed a little bit, you know, they spent so much time building up the relationship with Oliver, trying to get to know his sister for him to kind of not want to be as hard-headed and stubborn in saving his sister as he was determined in trying to kill his sister. I didn't really appreciate that. And I feel like he wouldn't have done that if that was Thea, you know, if you compare sisters. Because she also went down the dark path for a time being. And Oliver, as much as whatever she did, Oliver didn't give up on her. So I don't know. I don't really believe in this whole giving up on Emiko thing, even if she is absolutely definitely evil.
I just like the confirmation that Oliver and Felicity did actually abandon William and never spoke to him again. It's not great. I really thought they could use the whole grandparents excuse that they, you know, the grandparents kept him away, and then Felicity would be like, but we did send you all those voicemails, or we did try visiting, but no, they really did stay away to keep him safe or whatever, which is ridiculous considering the way, or considering they went through with having another kid, despite it not being safe to do so. Like, the logic is flawed. And I also didn't like that Mia got on William for daring to be angry with Felicity. So, like, Miss Mia, I ran away from home after finding out a secret and didn't speak to my mom for a year without even hearing her explanation. Smoke really tried to make William feel bad instead of just letting him be mad.
I forgot this happened.
When you saw that on, like, when that was happening.
This episode.
Because at least Felicity didn't leave her behind. William can be angry forever as far as I'm concerned.
Like, when that happened in the episode, she's like, oh, I didn't have a pity party. I'm like, excuse me?
She ran off and had a whole goth face. She did have a pity party.
Yes, she had
a whole goth face. Like, miss me with that.
And she's like, she's still so super broody, like, and he's not. He should actually be the brooding one, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, he should have just gotten to be angry, so I didn't like that she got on him for that. I liked seeing Tommy again, but I agree it was frustrating to watch Oliver have to be convinced that killing Emiko was a bad idea. It does really feel like they've regressed him to seasons 1 and 2, Oliver. Like, he was owning up to all the people he killed and taking responsibility, but just like that, he wants to kill his sister after Woy got back and after it was clear she couldn't be swayed to do the right thing, or really what, like, he wanted her to do, which is see the light and switch sides. So it's like a kid throwing away a toy just because he thinks it's broken. And
when did going to jail become, like, not an option? Like, why isn't putting her in prison or whatever where she can't hurt anybody not an option? Why is it, you know, no, let's just kill her.
Exactly. Exactly. And then given that none of his team members gave up on him despite him being a former murderer, you'd think he'd at least keep trying to reach out to her, or at the very least see that she's just like him from back then.
They didn't even treat Diaz this way. He tried to stop Laurel from killing Diaz.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
That's very true.
It's just like the way that they look at who's good and who's bad and who's done terrible things and who deserves to be redeemed is just kind of really fucked up. And I think after all this time, he shouldn't have to be convinced of doing the right thing and not killing anyone after all of these years. And then this is just, like, really random, but I found it odd how affected Dinah was about Roy risking his life to stop the rest of the building from coming down on them. Because she was so moved and scared, and I think it was Juliana's acting, but considering Roy is the reason she gave up her badge and lied about the death of two innocent guards to the police, I thought she'd have been harder on him and actually expected him to risk his life, knowing they'd all risked theirs for him, so...
And I wonder, like, how much of that, like, I know because some of that was actually going on while Oliver was hallucinating, but it seemed like also parts of that, the team, was part of Oliver's hallucinations as well or something like that. So I don't really know where the split was, but I just thought it was very, as a plot, the team, the rest of the Team Arrow plot was kind of underwhelming because everyone's like, oh no, Roy, you can't go into that crippling, you know, poisonous mist because you'll die when we know good and well.
He's gonna be fine.
Roy is alive and well. Everyone's holding their breath. Like, oh my god, will Roy make it? Stay tuned. Find out on the next guy called the
I totally forgot all of these plot points because they were so lame.
See, another penultimate episode that was underwhelming. Anyway, predictions.
More whelming than The Flash.
Yes,
though,
yes, for sure. Any predictions?
Well, I've been on my Oliver's Gonna Die in season 7 train for a while now, so I don't see why I should get off now.
Tati, do you have any predictions?
I don't think he's gonna die. I think that he's gonna send Felicity off and... Yeah, that's that on that. I don't know.
They have to explain why he's not in the future.
Hmm?
They have to explain why he's not in the future. And
well, I don't think they have to explain that now.
Yeah, like, okay, if he sent her off at in the finale, like, why would he stay away, like, 20 years later?
No,
yeah.
He dies in Crisis. What do you mean? He dies next year.
Oh, you're just saying he doesn't die in the finale, but he's going
I don't think he dies in the finale. I think he dies in the crossover. That's what I'm saying.
I still think he's getting snatched in the finale.
I know you do. So we'll see. This time next week, we'll know who's right.
Yes. So Oliver hasn't been... Obviously, he's on the future. But Diggle also never showed up in the future, did he?
No, but they mentioned him.
Yeah, I think
sporadically.
That's interesting and weird. So, side A, Lady with Gumption nominee, who do we vote for?
Lena Luthor.
Yeah, that's all I got. Lena Luthor. She's the one. The one and only.
Yep, same. No one for Arrow. Sorry, Arrow. All right, moving into side B. I don't have a clever title for this slash.
That's what the Flash deserves.
Because I just could not. I didn't even want to go back and try to find one. So this is what you got, Flash.
Side B, rewind. We the Flash, Legends, and Doom Patrol, titled I Don't Have a Clever Title for This, slash Nipnotize, slash Containment. Into the Flash, which does not have a title, Cicada 2 makes her move. Whatever that is. Team Flash is on high alert after Cicada 2 threatened. Is that honestly what they're calling her? Anyway.
I guess so. Cicada sounded more interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, Team Flash is on high alert after Cicada 2 threatens to unleash a dangerous virus that would put all metahumans at risk. Other stuff happened in the episode. Stefan
Plazinski
directed the episode, written by Judalina Neera and Thomas Pound. What do we like?
You know, after our Junalina defense squad last week, I felt a little bit underwhelmed that this is her final episode. Mm-hmm. But since this is likes, what did I like? I did like Joe at the precinct storyline. I thought it was a good foreshadowing into him one day being the captain of CCPD. And so him having to go through all of the bureaucracy side of the job of being the police officer, of being in the police force, and some of what Singh has to go through, and him kind of taking that on with this metahuman cure was a good kind of introduction into him, maybe seeing things in a different light. He's getting older, he's got a baby, he's got, you know, a grandchild from the future, maybe he's looking to settle down and not be in the field so much, because it seems like every time, every season, these meta storylines just stress him the fuck out. So perhaps like being at a desk job would be good for him in the coming seasons. So I did enjoy that part of it. The only part of the Sherlock Renee storyline that I liked was the fact that Renee didn't want to get the cure and that she likes being a metahuman. And I thought that was a plot point that should have been brought up a lot more in this side. So I actually liked that she didn't want the cure. I liked that Ralph had some common sense and was looking at the Thawne Shikata situation from a different angle that no one else was looking at. I thought it was pretty obvious that they weren't going to listen to him and that was going to be like the downfall. But I like that, you know, he was paying attention to more than just one disaster at a time. So while everyone was focused on one thing, that he was focused on looking ahead and actually kind of uncovering what Thawne's actual plan was. So I like the little continuity there between him seeing Thawne in the future and knowing something was up. I only wish they had like his nose wiggle, because you know, like that's the usual like telltale sign that he's like can sense a mystery. So that was the only thing that was missing, was his nose wiggle. Other than that, I don't have a lot of positive thoughts on this episode, so I'm gonna be quiet. Yeah.
Okay. I definitely liked the Joe storyline once I got past thinking that something was wrong with Jesse L. Martin again, or that like Joe was about to have like early onset Alzheimer's or something. I was very, very concerned because I was like, why is he not understanding the difference between like 2 and 3? They seem to be tripping up over 2 and 3 a lot. And I was like, does this have significance? But no, it did not. So once it was explained that he was just stressed about the idea of being under or being in charge, being in command, I thought that was interesting, because we're so used to Joe sort of like being the dad figure that one would expect that he's very good at being in command. But in fact, no one listens to him as the dad. So it makes sense that he doesn't actually know what it's like to be the boss and have people actually have to do what he says. So yeah, and I really loved how it showcased the partnership that he and Cecile have. I think that the show does a very good job of writing relationships of equals, of writing partners in life when they do showcase the relationships and when they do actually give them storylines like that. They've done that a lot for Barry and Iris, and we do see that in this episode, even though it's overshadowed by how dumb they're being about Thawne and Cicada. But we see Cecile truly understanding Joe and being able to reach out to him and lift him up when he needs it, and then him taking her advice and thriving because of it. So I like that a lot. And speaking of Barry and Iris, I like that we got to see them be on the same page as parents this episode, and that we saw them be concerned parents. And even as much as they were benching Nora when they didn't necessarily need to, we understand why they would, because we've seen her acting a fool for most of the season. So it makes sense that they would want her to sort of like assess the situation first before she rushes in. And also I liked that this time it didn't lead to kind of like temper tantrums, or, you know, it did lead to red lightning, but not in the same way. It didn't lead to like, I'm going to go team up with Thawne and whatever, wreck some havoc and start my own girl gang with guest star Ragdoll. So any of those things, they actually had like a real conversation about it, and they got to talk things out as a family and like a bunch of mature adults, which they all are. This is like many of our listeners pointed out, this is kind of the first episode where Nora acted like an adult. So that when she said, you know, I'm an adult capable of making my own decisions, I almost believed her, because for this episode she was. Before, not so much, but this time she was. You go, Nora. Also, I like Ralph now. So when he came in with this, with his little like whole thing planned out, where he figured out that we were in like a time loop, we had a time loop problem, I was like, yes, good job, Ralph. So I was proud of him. Unfortunately, no one else listened to him, but at least they set up what was going to happen at the end. Like, they hadn't done it yet. We had not yet gotten any reason to understand Thawne's plan, But they managed to do in one episode what they should have been doing all season. So I right. guess good job, Judalina, that you were forced to do that. But I don't know why they hadn't already done it. So
at it's least like I, they want to keep the surprise until the last minute, but doing that just like lessens the right. the impact of the surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's about it for my. Oh, you know what? I liked the speech that Renee gave about wanting to keep her powers and not wanting, you know, like she would rather live as herself or whatever, right? Than die on someone else's terms. So yeah, that was acceptable. And that's something they should have been discussing more in depth, but we'll talk about that later. All right, what did you like, May?
Only some things. we only briefly got a sense of Cisco's life pre-Star Labs, but it was probably the funniest moment of the episode. Like, I like the idea that he has an arch nemesis who eventually became a Nobel Prize winning scientist. And it sincerely makes me wonder what Cisco is doing in the future, because there's absolutely no mention of him. And then Ralph being the smartest person in the room the entire episode, like stepping up and being the only one to think that Thawne's plan has a plan. I'll chalk it up to him being also the one person who's never actually tangled with Thawne on any personal level for this light bulb moment that should have come episodes ago. But I'll let it go. After three seasons, it seems we're finally headed in the direction of Joe becoming captain of CCPD. The timeline is malleable because it was supposed to have happened by the end of season three, but the writers have short-term memory. His subplot involved some personal growth, and I really like that Cecile appealed to him by telling him he's already a capable leader because he's been a good dad and has had to deal with stressful situations all the time. His authority at the end made me cheer internally for him, but I also hope that his future captaincy, which also confirms to me that Joe's definitely coming back next season, but that it just means that Captain Singh will be promoted, like I said earlier, and not that he's going to die, because that would be very sad. Anyway, I did like some of the West Island family stuff. Nora finally acting and sounding like an adult, like both of you said, with a good head on her shoulders, and Barry and Iris being concerned that the negative speed force affected her and not wanting her to tap into the mind of a psycho were brief but nice. And I liked that they were on the same page again, which was really nice to see, because they didn't get much in the way of conversation, but at least we got them looking at each other to be like, let's have a connection right now and just have a conversation. I like that Nora also acknowledged that both parents have been there for her and not just Barry, specifically that she looked at Iris when she said that. So I'll take the crumbs at this point, it's fine. And then finally, another crumb, Barry finally got back up after being knocked down and took a good swing at Cicada. It only took 21 episodes, but you know, it happened. So on to what we did not like, which is a much, much longer list.
Yeah, it is. For this to be the penultimate episode, it's just very boring overall. There's nothing exciting about it, nothing that makes me really want to tune into the finale, even with the Thawne thing, because it wasn't even, like, Ralph threw it out there, and then it wasn't even really followed up, because they wanted to save all of that for a shocking finale, but it's not that shocking when we already know what's going to happen. It really bothered me that Iris didn't get to do shit all episode except look either mildly or moderately concerned when either her husband or her daughter did some stupid shit. Like, she didn't say, like, I don't even think she said much. Like, she didn't say much of anything, just a couple of lines and a lot of concerned looks. And I felt like, especially when Ralph brought up his Thawne theory, the journalist should have jumped out. And it annoyed me that she wasn't at least the least bit, like, curious or, you know, nothing sparked or suspicion to have her even like look at the board or do something else while everything else was going on. Because at least then when Thawne actually does come out and reveals that, aha, my evil plan works, at least then not all of the West Allen family would be looking dumb when Thawne outsmarts them. I thought that because a lot of the time she spent just in Star Labs looking concerned at computers and being like, oh no, that some of that could have been spent with her at least looking suspiciously at the board or like wondering, like maybe she doesn't figure it out all the way, but there should have been something there to connect what Ralph threw out into the universe to kind of tie it more smoothly into the finale than just him saying it. So I was annoyed that they didn't really let Iris be very active in either of the plots. With the Sherlock and Renee storyline, it ended up with her volunteer. Because they did this thing where they introduced her, and then, like, six episodes later, nothing for, like, six episodes. And then suddenly, it's a thing again. And suddenly, they're in love. And it ends with her, like, Sherlock is trying to be pushy and pushing Renee into getting this cure that he didn't even ask her if she wanted or not. She finally says that she didn't want it, and it ends with her, like, voluntarily stepping into a portal onto another Earth, which she has no idea what the fuck is on the other side of that portal, and Sherlock isn't even going with her. And so it's like, I don't know, like, have you really fallen for this guy so quickly? It's kind of early for me to buy that this is a love story, or for her, or that she actually loves him. When the back of my head, I'm just wondering, like, did he even tell you about the 11 other women that look exactly like you that he's tried to have a relationship with and they failed? Like, do you know this? He knew you were a meta before you even told him that you were a meta. He knew all this stuff about you. Did he even tell you that his history, and you're already stepping into portals that you don't even know what's going on, leaving your whole life? She didn't say goodbye to anybody. I'm sure she has people in her life. I think she had a dog. Like, she didn't say goodbye to anybody. She just walked through a portal. And I'm supposed to be like, yes, this was a great relationship arc. Thank you, Flash Riders. It just ended very clunky and weird to me. And that's like the end of that storyline. We're not going to see her again. And he's going to either die or finish what he's supposed to be finishing and then go and join her. And that's just going to be it. And so, like, why did we have this story in the first place? It doesn't really make sense. I applaud her for wanting to stay in meta, but I don't applaud her on her other decision-making skills, because I think Renee should have thought that one through. Speaking of to be or not to be a meta, this cure, like, the take the cure or die storyline is not much of a voluntary choice. Like, they spent this whole arc, several episodes of harping on this cure has to be voluntary, people have to not want their powers, and I feel like if the writers had any kind of semblance of balanced writing, instead of writing three episodes of the same to cure or not to cure plot, we could have gotten some exploration on this idea that some people, you know, that are, one, not evil, and are also not the main characters of the show, might actually be good people that like their powers and don't want to feel forced into being force between being who they are and death. Like, that just seems like two very extreme options. And, like, Renee's choice to not take the cure is barely even a blip in the grand scheme of the plot. So I wish a lot more time had been spent on what the cure actually means, not to just, you know, Cisco wanting to be normal versus being a hero. It also could have been expanded. Like, we had, like, maybe one episode of the meta that killed Grace's parents, and the fact that outside of the fact that it was an accident, that she's pretty normal, and I don't know if she's fine with, like, using her powers. There's a lot of things that were just kind of left under the rug or just glossed over because the writers don't really have the range to really explore what it means to be a meta, what it means to have powers, what it means to have the kind of power technology from the Enlightenment storm, whether that affects you negatively or not. There was just, like, it was mentioned and then it disappears and you don't see it again, and it's always brought in just for the sake of plot and not for the sake of development. And I think that's a huge issue with the Flash writers as room as a whole. And overall, the season has just been disappointing. It's been trash, but, you know, Arrow has survived trash seasons before, so I'm hoping that The Flash can also bounce back from this trash season. It will die with Crisis if it can't.
Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, I feel like my dislikes are almost all of the same ones, because it just wasn't a very good episode, but I definitely would have liked to see Iris get to do a little bit more. Again, our listeners have sort of touched on the problem, and the issue is that this is Nora's story, and it's not Barry's, so, like, people are not reacting in the way they would when it is Barry's story. They're kind of, like, forced to just, like, move aside so that Nora can have the spotlight, or whatever you want to call it, which was very much present here when we see even Barry just kind of acting as like concerned father figure and not really doing much on his own.
Not using his brain.
Yeah, exactly. But for Iris to not react when Ralph came in with his theory, which in and of itself is a bit problematic, just because it just don't understand why it would take someone 21 episodes to get to where Ralph got. Like, we've always known that Cicada was a murderer in Nora's future, or in Nora's past, rather, which is our future. And back then, Grace didn't have the dagger. So obviously the powers don't come from the dagger. Grace has the powers from somewhere else. So then Thawne's plan being related to the dagger means that either the Thawne's plan is dumb or Thawne's plan is evil. So I don't know. Like, it's just like, once he says it, it's like, well, yeah, why didn't y'all think about that long ago? So anyway, and then like, even after he says that, They realize like on their own that she has powers, which is something that we already knew or thought we knew. So I guess it's like they've been kind of showing or hinting stuff early on, and then they'll let episodes go by without touching on it again. So then I just forget and I just assume it's something we already know and we're going to move forward with this information. But then they have them like discover it again. And I was like, oh, okay. Like when we saw Cicada in Grace's vision and we realized Grace was Cicada. And then they didn't realize Grace was Cicada until like 4 more episodes, even though Nora had also been there in that vision. And it's like, well, didn't we already know this?
Or like when Sherlock was like, she's shady and working with someone from the future. And then the next episode, who is she working with?
Like, come on. Yes, exactly. So it feels like they're like rediscovering the same things over and over again. And that's what Ralph's little like whiteboard thing felt like. So the fact that they couldn't follow through, they couldn't like, didn't have the time to agree to look into Ralph's questions was just obnoxious. But anyway, aside from that, I didn't like that they spent time at all on Sherlock and Renee, just because the fact that they could spend time on Sherlock and Renee, like with the Arrow episode, just shows that there's not that much going on. They don't have enough actual plot relevance or things actually relevant to characters who are going to stick around past next week to fill the episode with. So I don't know. I think that was just like silly. And even though, like, although Renee made a good point, then it just brings you to like, why aren't they making this point for everyone? Just the idea of giving up powers, giving up part of who you are so that you don't get murdered is like really messed up.
Right.
Psychologically speaking, sociologically speaking, like whatever, you know, like there are plenty of real world comparisons that we could draw. It's not good that our heroes are like, yes, we'll just remove this part of you and then you won't get murdered. Problem solved.
And I know it would have been really interesting had any of Team Flash truly considered like taking the cure too, so that Cicada would have murdered.
Like, Cisco's like whole arc about, man, I don't want my powers. And they've had this cure for, like, weeks, and he still hasn't taken it. So, like, what's the deal?
Exactly. Cisco made the cure for him, quote-unquote cure. It's not even, you know, calling it a cure already is not good news. But Cisco made it for himself, and then it's not even brought up that he might want to use it. Even, like, Cecile, like, I have to assume that Cecile's mind-reading leftover abilities, it's still, like, does that classify her as a metahuman? Is she a metahuman? Would she be, you know, would she ping for Cicada? Shouldn't Joe at least be concerned about this if Cecile's not going to be?
I think they kind of, like, when she arrived in the end, he told her to run, like, and when Cicada was, like, drawing the power from all of it, it drew dark matter or whatever from Cecile, too, so I assume she is classified as a meta.
Yes, but she never considered taking the cure herself, or she never, you know, right. She's like, oh, here I am, just like ushering people in, but it wasn't like, I'm not gonna take it because I'm a main character of the show and therefore my powers are relevant. And then all these other characters who are nameless schmucks are not relevant. Their powers have nothing to do with their identity whatsoever, so they can just be removed.
And I thought it was weird that there was some that, you know, on the news they say, oh, there's a cure, and then all of a sudden all these people are like, yes, I want to take this, and like there is no kind of,
right,
you know what, I like my powers.
Yeah, at the very least, like, this would have been a perfect opportunity to bring back a meta from the past who could take the cure or not, right? And give some kind of like actually humanize a villain by giving them like a speech about powers or whatever, you know? Like, sure, maybe you'd want to take away my powers because I did this bad thing, but like this Joe over here didn't do whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and this person has just powers to heat up there.
Going back to that Anon who was talking about how like Team Flash didn't really care about young Grace, in this case, like they could have used the whole storyline to make the Flash look bad in the public eye because they could just blame him for causing the fact that they have to take this cure to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Carry on.
So, no, yeah. I mean, so it just shows how shallow this storyline is and how far they failed to take it. And then, yeah, I mean, other than that, I don't really know, like, what even to say. Like, I guess I was just, like, frustrated that, like, even at the very end, when they still did the vaporizing or sending to another place thing, whatever it is that happens with the dagger, whatever they did with it, they did that after they didn't need to anymore. Like, everyone's gone over this, but the moment when Cicada finally hits the ground, like, and they don't put her in, like, power dampening cuffs or whatever, you know? They don't try to take her away, and they're just like, I guess it's time to get rid of this dagger that we've already established we don't need to get rid of because she already has powers beyond this dagger. And then, of course, that's, like, what unleashes Eivar's plan, which I don't even understand. Do we understand? Do you guys know what the plan was? Like, do you guys understand what the dagger was?
Like, I feel like... the getting rid of the dagger in the present. I don't know what that has to do with the dagger in the future.
Well, if he has the dagger in the present dagger in the future, then maybe... Because, like, when Sisko used the mirror, whatever, it, like... evaporated the satellite thing, but no one knew where it went. And mm-hmm. So I figure the same thing, if they evaporate the dagger in the present, then that's connected to whatever is happening with the dagger in the future. And so maybe like right when, this is like prediction spoilers, but right when they're about to kill Thawne, the dagger will be like, oh no, I'm not supposed to be here in the future, and I'm connected to Thawne, so he's also going to disappear with me. And he'll go into wherever the Speed Force or wherever the trash that gets evaporated by the mirror thing goes. And that's how he'll escape.
That's interesting. It just makes me wonder why they didn't bring that weapon in earlier. But anyway.
Because the writers don't have the range.
They have to wait till the last moment for everything to suddenly not make sense. Was that the end of your dislikes?
I mean, yeah. Just pretty much that I feel like this episode would have been much better if they had spread out the storylines that matter in it over several episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I hear that. Yeah. And for me, honestly, like Todd's poor season-long planning really showed during this episode specifically. Like maybe the lack of a 23rd episode had something to do with it, but for a penultimate episode, all of the season-long problems came into sharp focus. There was entirely too much exposition and almost every single character was dumbed down for the sake of the plot. Every single one. Except Ralph. So if that has to happen for the plot to work, then your plot is stupid. There were at least 5 very stupid things that happened that made me wonder whether the writers even check any of their own notes or read any of their own scripts, because this episode pulled out shit that was made clear 5 and even 10 episodes ago. But somehow the characters had to wonder about them anyway. Like, I would have enjoyed Barry and Iris being concerned parents if it wasn't for the fact that they were concerned, what they were concerned about, or part of what they were concerned about, was nonsensical. Like, first of all, they feared that by having Nora tap into Grace's mind that she could be hurt, but that Grace could also find out where she and the rest of the team were. But I guess the writers forgot that in episode 16, adult Grace's first appearance was crashing Star Labs and taking the team out. So she's known all along where the team is located. Why would they care about that now? Second, the plot involved Nora figuring out where Grace was too, but that was a waste of time because Central City Citizen had already publicly announced that the CCPD would be handing out the metahumans.
Exactly!
On TV! So logically, Grace wanting to kill metas so badly would head there, so after 21 episodes, they finally had Nora acting like an adult, but they could have come up with another way to do that without making that whole subplot seem stupid. I'm going to use that word a lot. Point number 3 of this plot that makes no damn sense is that Caitlin and Sisko have been working on the cure all season, and Barry even had to go into the Speed Force for an hour to cook it, but now you're telling me that Caitlin can make the cure in a matter of hours to administer to the metas in the city? And then Barry saying they tested it was hilarious considering that they used it on King Shark against his will, and Caitlin and Sisko are very angry about it. And also, they made it a point to say that King Shark was different because he had animal DNA. So how could they be sure that this non-FDA-approved cure would work all of a sudden on everybody else? And it's not like they're giving the med as much of a choice besides take the cure or die, like you already said, Jess. And then Nothing makes sense. And everything hurts. Number four, Team Flash fretted about making sure to get rid of Cicada's dagger. And they made it sound like they didn't know Grace never needed the dagger because she already had powers. Like, you'd think that they'd remember that given that they battled her while she used it against them. Like, how many times does Barry need to be thrown and held against the wall with her fiery whip thingy or whatever it is that she calls it before he gets it? So it just, the whole episode wasted time on Sherlock's subplot as well with Renee. Like, I've been calling her Irene. I'm sorry. But that is how irrelevant she is.
I called her Irene in a review. And then someone was like, I know it's her name's Renee, but I know why you called her Irene.
Yeah. And then they wanted to justify sending Sherlock back to his Earth in the finale. So this is why that was happening. But they could have done all that without wasting precious screen time on two characters who aren't at all important or that interesting, especially at this point so late in the story. Renee wanting to stay a meta, fine. Her going to another Earth after finding out it existed minutes before, not good. Like, she didn't even stop to think about the logistics, and that's concerning with how cavalier her attitude is about all of this. Also, Sherlock saying she's been the one he's been waiting for is, like Jess said, like, is he not going to tell her he's been married 7-11 times to all the same versions of her? Because that's super creepy. Barry spent 3 episodes mad at Nora and saying that Thawne couldn't be trusted, so it makes zero sense that he wouldn't stop to listen to Ralph's theory about Thawne and Sakia's dagger the very next episode. And like you guys have already mentioned, even Iris, who's an investigative journalist, and hell, even Sherlock, who's a detective, even though he wasn't around, but they couldn't bother to at least be suspicious for 2 seconds before brushing Ralph off, because the plot had to work. And then Iris especially, who was more understanding of Nora working with Barry, could have questioned Thawne for the first time all season, and then the team could have spent the rest of the episode trying to figure out what Thawne really wanted instead of leaving all of that for the finale. Because now it just feels like there's a time crunch and they need to get everything done in 42 minutes and it makes no sense. So, like, their best villain has been rotting in a cell for 15 years and 21 episodes and only had 1 hour left to live, but the writers decided to keep him in there instead of exploring all of that. So in his place, we got Cicada, Flash's most boring villain. And someone who's able to knock out Team Flash for 21 episodes without anyone thinking it would be useful to carry around the damn metahuman cuffs for once instead of just standing there waiting for her to take everyone down, because they always stand around and it bothers me so much. It's like, why is no one doing anything? And even the West Allen family stuff felt subpar because it played fourth fiddle to everything else that was happening. Like, yes, Iris should have definitely had more to do than remain silent for a lot of it. And then after an entire season of Barry and Iris being parents, this was one of those times where they really should have had a conversation about Nora that didn't have to do with Thawne or avoiding Iris. This was a lesson for them to truly let go and trust Nora, and one where they were finally on the same page after everything. But the only thing Grant and Candace got to do was give each other silent looks before coming to the conclusion that Nora should make her own choices. So I guess that conversation must have happened psychically. And it's frustrating that they were shortchanged while Grace had enough screen time to throw tantrums and Renee got to voice her issues with taking
the cure. Oh, I forgot to say that. Like, that little scene where she's just like grunting and throwing things in her mind was just like the most cringy thing ever.
Yeah. Oh my God. And then Barry being frustrated and hiding his face with his jacket was honestly me the entire episode. All of this to say, my long rant, that this episode was a huge mess. It was a shit show. I thought it was boring. The schmines and the exposition were overbearing. Most of the plot made no sense. And I think any minimal logic the writers ever had was tossed out the window for the sake of convenience. So I've never, never been more ready for the season to be over at this point.
And one thing I will say also about, like, the West Allen, because I didn't like it either. Like, I felt like, I know a lot of people are like, oh, yay, finally West Allen get to be parents. But, I mean, like, they've been being parents, quote unquote, for like the whole season. Like, I would have preferred if, instead of saying Nora no, it's too dangerous, the whole episode, that they had actually, from the end of the last episode, used this episode to be like, have all of the team members of West Allen working at full cylinders and actually working as a team, would have been a better thing than, okay, we're not gonna let you do this because we're your parents. JK, we are going to let you do this because you're an adult. Like, the whole, I didn't even like it. I didn't like it at all.
Yeah. Well, one episode to go. Do we have predictions for it?
That it will suck.
Basically that, yes. And, you know, the same prediction as always. Nora is going to wind up erasing herself in one way or another. I do think that Thawne will be released to be a bigger threat next year. But that Nora's sacrifice will in some way stop the immediate threat, mm-hmm. which I guess is Cicada. So.
Yeah. And I already kind of said my prediction about, like, the mirror gun and how Thawne actually plans on escaping, because I think that when they erase the dagger in the present, or, like, capture it and put it in the mirror world, or wherever it goes, then because it's no longer in the present, that means it also cannot be in the future. And because Thawne has it taped to his body, that means whatever happens to the dagger also happens to him. And that will be how he escapes capital punishment.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. So yeah. You're saying that he's going to, like, go with the dagger?
Yes.
Okay.
Interesting. I'm convinced that part of whatever arc Nora has is for her to finally own up to her mistakes, even though it took forever, and be an adult. So after she finds out Thawne used and betrayed her, because everyone was kind of telling her that anyway, but now, you know, she's going to see it for herself. She's going to end up sacrificing herself to save her parents, like Tati mentioned briefly. But, you know, she'll return in some way, so all hope is not lost. I definitely don't think so. Joe is definitely not gone. Cecile's definitely staying. This is my little scorecard.
Sherlock is going to go. He's going to live. Get to have Renee on another Earth, even though he has not earned a relationship with Renee. He's going to get it anyway. So he can go.
It earns us some, hopefully, less of him in general next season. So
Well, he's still got to play Eobard. So he's going to. Tom will still be around as a cast member.
Okay. I don't need another Wells. If he's just playing Eobard, yeah. Whatever. Yeah. So that's where we are. And moving on to a better episode, Legends of Tomorrow. What would Rey do? With Constantine missing, the Legends struggle to find a way to track him. When Sarah hesitates to make a tough call, Rory steps up, creating a wedge in the team. Meanwhile, Ava gives Gary the responsibility of handling the Bureau performance reviews for all the agents, not knowing that he is now an agent of Neron. What did we like about this episode?
Well, I think that I liked a lot Mona in the Bureau and Gary's nipple and its evil vengeance. those moments were alternately hilarious and excellent. It was nice to see Mona actually get to be observant and intelligent and help save the day for once. I think that the Bureau is definitely where she belongs. Also, I liked seeing Ava and Nora getting along so well after their, like, original spats when Nora was a prisoner. It's nice to also see, like, Nora start to fit in the Bureau as well. Also, hypnotizing is the best phrase, and I want to use it all the time. I loved Charlie kind of proving herself to have all that character development that people were accusing her of lacking. Yes. It's nice that we get to see her having internalized Rey's optimism and wanting to help the team come back together with it. Like, she might like being cynical and sarcastic, like, on her own, but that doesn't mean that she wants everyone else to be, right? She's got to have some balance. Also, I liked how Rey's positive influence permeated throughout the episode, and that his love of teamwork saved the team, even when he was not around to do it. So it also set up, like, exactly why they need him. And they should save him instead of just letting him rot in hell. Cards to Save the Timeline and the, like, Rey Palmer's Survival Guide, both great. I loved those bits and that whole games that came out of that as well. I also, I like Nora getting possessed by Tabitha at the end, even though, like, that sucks.
Did we see that?
I feel like there's, like, it that moment where you see her. Yeah, like, you see her face and you're like, oh, this is like, a Rey moment. It sucks for her. Sucks that she spent most of her life possessed by a demon, but it's great for me because it means that I get Dark Adam. Dark Adam, which is Dark Adam.
Dark Adam.
So, also, Neron making out with Tabitha as Rey and old ass fairy godmother was amazing.
I bet that actress had, like, the best day ever on set. She tried to, like, make out with Brandon Ralph.
She's living her best life.
Because that was a long kiss, too, and they had, like, multiple angles.
Yep.
I feel like Mona's storyline in this episode in the Bureau just validates what I said last week about how she's a better character in the Bureau storyline as opposed to in the Legend storyline. I thought that she had a really good episode with, you know, noticing that something was wrong in the Bureau and how everyone was seemingly repeating that Gary is all the man they need, because that would be creepy to me. So I'm glad that she picked up on it. And then her trying to recruit Nora to help kind of solve the mystery and work together and put it together like an actual plan to trap Gary, I thought was really smart. I really liked that Nora's first assignment as a Time Bureau agent was paperwork and all of like the introductory stuff that you have to fill out when you first start a job. And especially like her relationship with Ava and how it has developed, like Tati said, from the first time when Nora came in as a prisoner until now. And I it was a really sweet moment when Ava told Nora that she was proud of her joining like the Bureau and Nora not wanting to mess that up and Nora wanting to do good. I thought was all really kind of sweet. I like that they brought up the fact that a lot of Nora's paperwork is kind of tricky because in the present timeline, she's like 15 and in a mental institution. And considering the fact that we have like Anons asking us, how old is Nora? I'm glad that they actually like heard and confirm that in this episode what her actual age is in present, and then you can like project that out into the so that was all good. I like the whole and also another thing that we've been getting like a lot of Anons talking about, the whole Zarly versus Zatari, Nate and Zari. And I think one of our Anons was saying, like, you know, I've seen a lot of similar things between, you know, fans of Supercore and how they feel about James, and then in the Legends fandom, fans of Zarly and how they feel about Nate, and what are your thoughts on that, and how is this one different from the other one? And I think that for me, the one of the things is that people kept bringing up that Zarly doesn't have a lot of development, and so it would be kind of weird to put her in a relationship with Zari because Charlie's not fully fleshed out, but you see in this episode just kind of how much Charlie has changed from the time that we first saw them in episode like 3, I guess. So in the course of maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 episodes, Charlie's gone from being a very selfish, self-preservation first and only kind of character to spending the season finale trying to unbreak time after seeing all of the effects it has on the rest of the Legends, saving all of the Legends. And now in this episode, Charlie's the only one trying to keep the team together. It just kind of shows like how much Charlie has come to care about the Legends. While I thought the argument between Mick and Sarah was kind of dumb, them kind of like throwing jabs at each other about Mick only cares about his book deals and scamming people, and then Sarah only cares about Ava. I thought that was dumb, but I thought the core of it and them coming to kind of reminisce about them being the last of the two OGs along with Ray, and how far they've come, how far they've grown from season one, I thought that was a really nice moment to share between the two of them being the originals. And then kind of the coming together of embracing finally after seasons of Ray trying to embrace this like team building exercises and games, and finally like coming together and using his survival guide and Cars to Save the Timeline game to kind of reconnect on what it means to be Legends, what it means to be a family, and the fact that Charlie's card about, you know, teamwork and staying together and trusting your family was the last light bulb that saved before like the defrosting of the time ship saved them from the avalanche was all like really good. I thought it was interesting with Neron and John how Neron kept bringing up the fact that are all the people that John sent to hell really deserve to be in hell, and that kind of exploration with John and the Pooka and his ancestor trying to condemn the Pooka to hell when John knows that this species isn't only like reflects the energy that you give to it. And so it'll be interesting to see what hell is like for John, even though I thought it was kind of weird that hell looks like Gotham City. But that, and then of course, like the Tabitha actually being the fairy godmother, I thought was a good, kind of like Gary and the unicorn, Tabitha being the fairy godmother is another good circle back to the beginning of the season and kind of connecting all of the dots together. So I thought that was good.
I wish we'd gotten more of it, but this episode showcased how much Charlie has grown as a person. Like, of everyone on the ship, she would have been the last one to have wanted to bring everyone back together at the beginning of the season. Now she doesn't want Sarah and Mick to fight. So growth. Ava telling Nora she's proud of her was a very sweet moment and something Nora needed to hear after spending so much time being punished and punishing herself for last season's actions. So I thought that was a great, you know, cathartic moment for her and between the two of them since they had clashes before. Mona finally being back at the bureau was refreshing, even though I don't know why no one kind of just raised their eyebrows as to why she was there, but I let it go. It was a reminder that she's so much better when she's there. I like how active she was in trying to take down demon servant Gary and how she and Nora worked together to do it for the most part. And then I laughed when, you know, Gary started sending everyone to get their performance reviews. I always enjoy it when the writers remember how much the Bureau is still an agency that has regular job rules and the dreaded performance reviews were made to be 10 times worse because that's where everyone was being sent to be hypnotized. I died watching the characters say that word with like a completely straight face. It was hilarious.
Right.
Wolfie biting off Gary's demon nipple was really disgusting, but I'm glad Wolfie was put to good use this time around. Because Mona calls her Wolfie, so that is what I'm going with. I actually like that Sarah and Mick fought, if only because it led to that nice moment that Jess mentioned about, you know, them being the last of the originals. I think it's a reminder of how far they've come and how they both have lives outside the Wave Rider now, which wouldn't have happened back in season one. And I also felt like it felt like foreshadowed to me. But
foreshadowed to the end of the series next season when they all die in Crisis.
Yep. It was interesting also to learn that Constantine's ancestor was the one who caused the rift between humans and magical creatures. Like, it further ties Constantine to the story because it's more than Neron he has to fight back against now. And then finally, the fact that Tabitha turned out to be the fairy godmother will never not be funny. Like, that whole sequence and everyone's shock was just like, oh, that's Tabitha? That was really good.
That was excellent.
I love the fairy godmother so much. But what did we not like about this episode?
I feel like generally there was like a sense for me that certain characters were being made to act in certain ways so that something could happen. Like Mick just like randomly being convinced that Ray was gone and that therefore he should shoot him. Right. In order to leave them stranded in the Ice Age, Donner Pass, whatever it was. I like the storyline that it led to. But I thought it was ridiculous. First off, it's ridiculous to me that Gideon would just listen to him. Because then, like, what's the point of Sarah being the captain? Then anyone can just be like, Gideon! Sarah doesn't want to do the thing, but do the thing! Like, okay! And also, it doesn't make sense that, like, anyone would think that Ray was dead and gone to begin with. I understand that at that moment, Constantine was saying it because he's, like, a hologram, right? Or whatever, he's not really Constantine, maybe? But Constantine still thought that after. Like, everyone was just like, I guess Ray's just dead.
If it's different because Ray voluntarily gave himself up versus Neron, who John sent to hell.
I guess that's what it is. But, like, we know that that's not going to be the case. Like, we know because Nora also voluntarily gave up her soul to whatever the fuck he is. I can't remember his name. But, so, yeah. So, So I just can't imagine them just being like, yeah, I guess it's over now. When you've got like three instances of people in one way or another being taken by demons and then coming back. But
they didn't even try.
Yeah, they didn't even try. Like, after everything Ray's done for you. I was so mad about this. But anyway, yeah, like, they just saved Ava from purgatory. Dez was like in hell for a year. And this was after, like, Constantine was like, it's probably too late to save Ava. It's been a couple hours. I guess we're done. And then they still did it. And they're like, oh, good. I guess you can do it, you know? And then Dez also came back. So I'm like, what are you? Okay, whatever. So yeah, Constantine's suffering from memory loss in this episode, clearly. But it also made the sense to me that Constantine needed Neron to explain to him that not everyone in hell deserves to be there. Like, isn't that like Constantine's life story? Doesn't he know this? Like, he has this problem with Astra. He had this problem with Dez. Like, of course not everyone in hell deserves to be in hell. And I don't know why, like, a baby Pooka or whatever it was called was, like, required for him to, like, wake up and stop sulking. Like, again, we've already gone over this. We know magical creatures have feelings. Charlie is a magical creature. You spend most of the season with Charlie. Like, why is it something like, oh, wow, maybe you have a point, Neron. So yeah, again, it just like feels like we're repeating the same lessons over and over again. I don't know why. Nate, Zari, and the dragon egg. I'm not even mad. I'm just like bored. Like, I don't care. They had sex to create heat for their dragon egg. Just like Nate and Maya had sex.
It's kind of gross.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's gross. It's like the most heterosexual thing that's ever happened. Like, the heterosexual agenda was very clear in this moment. Yes. Also, I was like, did we suddenly warp into an episode of The Magicians? But that's fine. Also, copying Nate and Maya, who had sex to create heat when they were like dying of hypothermia or whatever. So yeah, maybe come up with something new.
Couples and... that can't imitate. Welcome to my TED Talk part two.
But yeah, I also feel like it's another instance of Zari propping Nate's story. And again, like, even though she has her own connection to Rey, and she could have her own feelings about Rey, you know, being gone or in hell or whatever, but instead it's like, oh, I'm sad because my bestie Rey sacrificed his soul for me. And then Zari has to, like, you know, lift him up or whatever. And again, like, it's not like, if you're in a show, even though this still bothers us when it happens on, like, The Flash or whatever, but, like, if you're in a show where you're the lead and then the other characters are supporting cast members, then it makes sense that more often than not, they're there to prop you up, right? But this is an ensemble show. And even if it wasn't an ensemble show, Nate is not the one that the ensemble should center around. Doesn't even make sense. So, yeah. And then lastly, I don't understand Mona's new wolf thing. I thought that she was just a werewolf, and so then sometimes she'd wolf out. But now it seems like the wolf inside her is, like, a different entity that she can talk to. It's not just her in wolf form.
So is it
like the BTS fan fictions where they do the, like, werewolf stories, and they're like, my wolf is horny right now? Or is it, like, a Killer Frost situation?
That's like a personality? BTS fan fiction?
When they have werewolf BTS fanfics, I came across on by accident, and I was horrified. I'd never again. I was like, wait, what's happening? Okay. Or is it literally, like, Kanane is inside her right now? Like, is it wolf Kanane? Is it just another wolf? Like, what's happening? So that's my question.
That is so weird that there is BTS science fiction fanfic.
It's like Alpha, Omega.
What
do
you even search for? What now?
Nazis love a BTS.
No, I don't love BTS. BTS is not even my group.
Well, the fact that you follow them makes me learn new things.
It's ABO fanfiction. Other things have it, but it's usually for dudes, because what the point is, like, it's when you just, like, love a bunch of guys and you just don't care about women. That way you could just have some of the random wolves, like, be able to get pregnant even though they're men. That's why. What? That's why. Moral of the story.
Okay, let's climb out of this rabbit hole. Back to the legend.
Sorry. Don't listen to this.
Also, I'm very sorry. Tati doesn't like BTS.
I don't have a lot of angry BTS people either. They're just not my old group. Oh my god.
Wow. We're gonna have like BTS like
I like BTS. I just don't like ABO fanfics.
Anyways, back to this episode and the whole Nate Zari manufactured romance. I think it just continues to, like I said last week, I don't really have a problem with Nate as a singular character. And so he's not like the whole comparison between what's Lena and James versus Zari and Nate. I would say that the main thing that for me is different is what Tati mentioned earlier about how a lot of things Nate as a white man, and he's not even the lead white man because Ray is technically the lead with Sarah. Like, Brandon and Katie are the leads of this ensemble show. But a lot of the storyline from the moment that Nate joined the cast has centered him in a lot of ways. And he takes away from, like, other storylines that and they center around him. And so, like, the fact that Zari and Nate, I cannot even mention an episode before this season where they were ever even paired up as just a friend pairing for the episode. Like, she's had pairings with Constantine, she's had pairings with Ray, and episodes where they had plots together. She and Nate have not even had a conversation, a platonic conversation at all before this season, and now suddenly the first time that we ever get any information that Zari is interested in Nate is through a rom-com trope plot of, like, fake dating. And then their next major milestone of them actually going on a date is a forced plot that Sarah put them on a mission together, filled with rom-com tropes of, you know, dating shenanigans and you know, secretly attracted to one another shenanigans and all this kind of stuff. And then again, in this episode, you have more rom-com tropes of, oh my gosh, we have to keep this egg warm. Oh my gosh, we're fake parents because we have an egg together. And it's every single thing of them has been, like, manufactured. If you have to use a rom-com trope Bible every single time that you write the like a pair together because you have no kind of background depth or inspiration of the two of them and how they develop as a couple, then that's kind of like, it's clearly, like, manufactured. And that's not just me saying that because I prefer Zari with someone else. It's the fact that it's true. Like, there's nothing that has genuinely developed over the course of any kind of season between Nate and Zari for me to really believe that this has been a genuine arc that's been developed and is doing anything for either one of them. Because, like, Nate had a story all of his own about his dad dying, and now his story is that his boyfriend was possessed by a demon and almost killed him, so now he's sad about that. And all of that serves Nate. Like, Zari being with Nate serves Nate in his grief over his dad and Ray. Zari being with Nate has not served Zari at all. Like, I don't know anything new about Zari that I did not know before. It's not really setting up anything about her future plot storylines that I can see right now. Everything about Zari and Nate being together is so that Zari can prop up Nate. And that's not really what I'm interested in. I didn't ask for it. I say it again, like, every single week, like, I didn't ask for this. There's nothing in this that really adds to any story other than Nate being sad and having someone to have sex with, and that's it. And the only thing that they have, that other legends have talked about, because all the other legends have pushed for Zari to be with Nate, and they pushed for a sexual relationship with Nate and not for any kind of emotional connection. There's nothing in this romance that seems more, like, deeper than a shallow puddle on the road after a light rain. And that's it. That's all I have to say about that.
I fully agree with that. But before I get to Zari and Nate, while I like that the fairy godmother's back, her returning and, like, I have questions. I have a lot of questions. So her returning in her full form makes me wonder why Neron kidnapped and prepared Ava to hold Tabitha's essence or whatever it was that she was supposed to be doing. So all he had to do was find Constantine and get him to open a portal, and that's it. But it makes me think that they did that just to have Ava and Sarah go through purgatory together, which is fine, but now it makes no sense to me. And then Mick making the executive decision to fire Ray / Neron was really annoying because, first of all, like, who died and made him captain? There was a reason Sarah hesitated, and it just made it seem like he didn't care for Ray or even trying to save him. It led to the fight with Sarah, which was mostly me being frustrated at Mick, who should have apologized first since he's the one who landed them in their situation to begin with. And I'm not too thrilled that Wolfie isn't just Mona turning into a Cope, but that Wolfie has, like I said, a whole separate personality like Killer Frost, and it's confusing. Because all Konane did was scratch her, so it should have been more like a werewolf, like Tati explained. Which that's how I thought it was going to be too, but it's not. And that's weird and unnecessary. And then another thing that really bothered me is that Constantine really jumped into the portal to hell, one-way ticket that he knows of, knowing he may not get out, and didn't make the attempt to throw Neron in there with him. I think that was a missed opportunity. And it's also frustrating because they didn't really explain Neron's possession either. Like, I was under the impression that Desmond was still occupying his body, but that, you know, like, he was somewhere in his mind that he was being pushed aside. And the same goes for Rey. But now Rey's in hell when it only seemed like Desmond had been in hell because Neron had been there and not on his own, if that makes sense. And then Constantine taking a one-way trip to save Rey, but never having done that for Desmond rings false to me because they set up this whole sort of love story going into like the mid-season finale. And Desmond was someone Constantine loved and had a life with. And I know Constantine cares for Rey, but it makes no sense that he would sacrifice himself to save him versus his ex-boyfriend. So it just comes off as being disingenuous.
Well, John's woke now. Now he knows.
Now he knows. After all this time, we wasted moping. And then finally, Nate and Zari. Like Jess already pointed out in her very lengthy, detailed points about why they're just not clicking for me either.
Okay, I talk too much.
They've already moved on to co-parenting their baby dragon egg, which is really weird. And the writers use the same setup, like Tati said, for them having sex that they used with Nate and Amaya. So it's frustrating that this just seems like a 2.0 version of the previous ship instead of its own thing. And then again, still Zari's getting nothing out of this. Like, first she's consoling Nate after his dad died, and now she's consoling Nate over the loss of Rey. And what's sad is that Rey was also her friend, and we didn't get much perspective about how she feels regarding his possession, because I remember last season they had a lot of scenes together. And
yeah, her first like major story arc was with Rey, like in when he was like the 1986 plot when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That was, she had nothing to say about it, so I thought that was really annoying. Do we have any predictions?
I think that it's got two episodes left, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what I predict. Like, the power of love will save both Rey and now Nora. But I do think that, like, there's going to be a cliffhanger for this season. Because I feel there's always a cliffhanger, yes. But I mean, like, I feel like they're not going to wrap up the, because, like, Tabitha just popped up two episodes before.
Right.
So I feel like the Neron and Tabitha storyline won't wrap up by the end of this season.
That's a good prediction.
Do you have anything to add?
Not anything positive.
Okay, tell us all the negative.
I don't know. I just hope that Mona will, her storyline wraps up, because I really don't see how she's, unless Gary just does not come back to kind of piggyback off of Tati's storyline. If Tabitha Neron isn't finished by the end of the season, and Gary being evil is not always also finished by the end of the season, that would give room for Mona to go back to the Bureau and be the Bureau mascot. Otherwise, I don't really know what the point is for continuing to have her on past this season. So if she does end this season, then I would hope that, you know, something will happen where she can be Wolfie full time and go live with Konane in Hawaiian paradise.
Yeah, I think if Gary ever does leave, it'll be because he realized he's better than this and he should go somewhere where people appreciate him.
I think that part of the whole saving Rey and Nora, whatever, will also have to be saving Gary and somehow proving to him that they actually care about him will be the only reason why he would drop Neron.
Agreed. All right. Doom Patrol, our final show in this very long podcast. After escaping the ant farm with Flex and Tallow, the Doom Patrol tries to restore his memory and abilities in order to find the chief. Meanwhile, Rita confronts her doubts with the help of a stranger, and Larry realizes how tied he is to the negative spirit. What did we like about this episode?
I feel like this episode was a refreshing, like, pickup and pace compared to some of the previous episodes, especially, like, the Chief backstory episode really dragged. It felt like it hit like a little mid-season slump. But I feel like in this episode, especially towards the end, it really kind of ramped up the energy heading towards the finale. I really enjoyed Flex Mentallo a lot. Loved getting to see his backstory. I like how it started out really campy and bright with him and his wife and the kind of corny old school comics where everyone's like, oh, yay. And like, he doesn't curse. He's like, oh, gosh, darn it. And, you know, all this kind of like corny stuff. I like how it's revealed. I like how it's not revealed immediately that he's actually inmate 722. That could hear Vic's struggles with Grid last week. But then, so when you see it kind of unraveling, you step back and you include the previous episode. The previous episode is kind of like a preview to Flex's backstory. And the way that the writers introduced him, basically like right under the audience's noses, was pretty clever. You can also see how much he's changed being held prisoner in the ant farm through his interactions with Vic and Grid last week. He was very kind of like curious. He could hear Grid and he was, you know, curious as to what was going on, but ultimately, he was completely complacent in where he was within his prison and didn't really kind of rush to help or do anything. Versus in this episode, his interactions with Larry and Sparky in the flashback to the 60s before he was broken, when they first brought him to the ant farm and he was all kind of like ready to go, very in tune with Sparky, who he called the negative spirit, and Larry, and trying to like break free and, you know, being very optimistic and very hopeful and very confident in himself. And I feel like the main thing is, though, is how Flex's relationship with his wife, Dolores, and their romance really kind of ties the whole episode together. I love the story of their romance. It's really sweet and beautiful watching them be happy and beginning on the picnic together. And then, like, even in the, you know, how they were talking about, you know, you're the light of my life, and how he always like loved her smile and like the laughter. And then even in the face of him being like tortured in the ant farm, like his strength and confidence, part of his strength and confidence and resolve to escape was connected to getting back to Dolores. And so then it was hard to see the ant farm use his love for his wife to break him by showing her through like that TV screen being tortured and then continuing to harm her if he didn't conform. And then you think about how every day, the only thing that he had to look forward to in that little prison was a glimpse of his wife on like the TV screen. And then you go back to the previous episode, and you link back to how Vic, you know, found him glued to that TV screen in the previous episode. And now, like, he's glued to the soap operas, and you kind of wonder, like, I really wondered, like, where in that line of breaking him they phased out showing him Dolores for, like, mindless soap operas. So it's kind of like TV really does rot your brain, but it was connected to the fact that the original purpose for the TV was to show him his wife, and that was the one thing that they used to break him. And then you also add to that the fact that one of the first things that they tried to do was put clothes on him. So, you know, in the beginning, Flex Mentallo, all he's wearing is like some banana shorts. He's very proud of his body, like flexing his muscles is how he uses his powers. And you can't see him flex if he's wearing clothes. So obviously he doesn't wear a lot of clothes. And it kind of reminded me of the whole kind of, you know, Adam and Eve story in the first sin, and how it was only after eating the apple and gaining knowledge that they recognized and became ashamed of their nakedness. And so it felt kind of like an Adam and Eve story. A lot of Flex's powers are also linked to his lack of clothes and his appreciation for his body and his ability to flex, to activate his powers. So in a way, clothing him and making him ashamed of his nakedness was also part of stripping him from his power. So mm-hmm. clothing him and keeping Dolores from him just kind of shows the true cruelty and the depth of the inhumanity that the Bureau of Normalcy has. And even to kind of cap it all off at the end with their reunion at the end of the episode, it was just tragic and very emotional and very sad. And you see the depth to which not only was Flex being brainwashed, but also Dolores was being brainwashed and forced and threatened that if she ever tried to find Flex or to save Flex, then something bad would happen. And sure enough, when they do get reunited and they finally are kind of aware and recognize each other through like their laugh and his smile and her laugh and everything, and they kind of have this brief, very sweet reunion that she disintegrates and he doesn't have her. Like they spent all this time trying to get back to each other and they finally get back to each other, and it's just awful and sad, and like I cry, like I hurt all over. So I enjoyed all of that. And then on the other side of the story, I liked that even though I knew it was a setup from the beginning, Rita finally opening up about her trauma and the secret that she's been carrying around for so long, and how her greed and to be a star kind of outweighed her kind of morality and her moral compass of sending these women, these young naive starlets, to the film producer, and then, you know, one of them actually getting pregnant, and how she kind of turned her back, and then that wound up in tragedy, and Rita has been holding on to that ever since. And so I like that even though it was definitely Mr. Nobody from the beginning, and it was very clear that it was Mr. Nobody from the beginning, I like that it still allowed Rita to kind of have some growth and to kind of take the next step and not have the cloud of her secret holding her back. And then also, a very minor note, the continuation of the the episodes of Animal Vegetable Mineral Man and his trial in the background continues to be very hilarious. And a nice source of comedy to kind of thread through even from the beginning. Like, this completely random character has been doing stuff in the background the whole season, which is awesome. And then finally at the end, when Mr. Nobody makes the appearance that we know he was going to make, I love the fact, the whole like breaking of the fourth wall and Mr. Nobody being like, finally, the Doom Patrol you always wanted to see from the beginning. And he's got like Doom Patrol and DC merchandise and like the poster for the actual show. And, you know, all of that going was just really hilarious, fourth wall breaking. And I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I also liked pretty much the whole episode, especially the way that they did Flex Mentallo's backstory. They really set up him and Dolores really nicely so that they felt like a real love story, and I was really rooting for them, and I found their reunion really emotional and beautiful, and then tragic and horrifying. And I was actually crying as I was watching. I was like, oh no, I can't believe this is happening to me. But yeah, I thought that he was such a sweet guy too. Like, and I like how it contrasted with like what you would expect him to be just based on like his look, right? Right. You'd expect him to be just like,
obnoxious,
you know,
and arrogant.
Exactly. Obnoxious, Cliff. Arrogant, right? Sure. Surfer dude, Cliff kind of guy. But he was just like a really like sweet man who just wanted to help everyone. And that he was a hero because he liked helping people, not necessarily just because he liked how his muscles looked. Although, of course, he did like how his muscles look as well. And I really like just like how he could even communicate with the spirit, with the energy spirit inside Larry, right? Like, he immediately knew what it wanted and wanted to help it, something that Larry couldn't do for decades. So yeah, it just shows how pure of heart and precious he is. And also, it then casts a new light on the previous episode with Vic, where we see like what he's become. You know, we actually got to see like kind of like how empty his mind now was, right? And how little he remembered, which is like obviously a curse for him, but in a way is a blessing because everything that he's probably thinking would be thinking of otherwise is like painful. So yeah, I really liked I liked how they used the soap opera to try to get him to remember things, but like Jessica was saying, TV rots your brains. It was just further alienating him from the truth, even though it was connected to what his past was, because the TV was how they were first showing him Dolores, which somehow eventually became the soap opera, and we still don't know the answer to that, but that's fine. And then of course we connect Cliff. I like how everyone was being connected, right? Rita recognized him from the cereal box. Larry was trapped in the room with him. And then Cliff guest starred on the soap opera that he was watching. So that part where they were like watching Cliff, and then like at first they were making fun of him, and then afterwards they were like, you should get a, like, you almost got a daytime Emmy or whatever for that. Like, that was pretty funny. Also, I thought it was like interesting, I guess. It was nice to see Jane and Cliff work out their issues with each other while they were trying to help Flex Mentallo. And I also liked when they were having that fight at the beginning, like Cliff was like, bring Flit out, like make Flit take us somewhere. And then she's like, that's not how it works or whatever. Like, they were fighting with that. And then Flit came out on her own and then and took them to where they needed to go, which I liked because like on the like, I totally understand Jane, like, right. All the personalities are like their own people who are going to do what they want to do when they want to do it. But I also like that they're like, Cliff is right in the sense that like there is like a sense of unity there, right? Like, they're all working together to be one in one body. So like, presumably Flit would want to get them out of there so that they don't die, because then Flit would also die. So yeah, I liked that. I also like Jessica. We knew very early on, we're like, that old man is Mr. Nobody. We're like, well, he's somebody, and that somebody might be Mr. Nobody. But I did like that we finally learned the truth behind that baby situation that was going on, and that the truth was so much more complicated and something that I think anyone would feel guilty about. Because, like, for a little bit, I was concerned, and I think Jessica even mentioned while you're watching, like, that it would be like, oh, she had an abortion so she could further her career or whatever, you know? And I'd be like, is that really, like, something that the show should be punishing for her for, you know? But then the way that it was, which was, like, straight out of, like, Harvey Weinstein playbook situation, you know, was like, oh, this is, like, real-world scenario and deeply upsetting. So, like, I totally understand why she's beating herself up about this 50 years later. And yeah, so I also think that, you know, I'm not sure, like I was thinking, like, how old is that child now? Like, is that something that we could, like, could she find right. that child now as, like, a 60-year-old man or whatever, or, you know, however old that person would be? Kind of like how I'm thinking, like, oh, well, maybe next season Larry should go look for his kids, you know? I think it's nice that they're setting up ties to the real world that could still be played on in future seasons.
I also like that it played into her naivete of what the girl she was setting up with the Hollywood producer were actually doing to get these roles, but also like her kind of her brushing things under the rug and right. not absolving her of that, because she benefited from it. She knew she benefited from it, and she continued to do it for a long time.
Yeah. Agreed. So yeah, I liked all of that. And then finally, you know, thank God Silas Stone is alive. Vic again did not get to do very much this episode, but at least he will not have to think that he killed both his parents in future episodes. So blessings. So those were my licks.
Yes to Silas being alive. I was so relieved. I also like that we got to learn about Flex and how he was kidnapped by the Bureau. It was really sad to watch and know that he couldn't remember anything from his previous life because the Bureau had made sure that he wouldn't. And then the moment with old Dolores was really nice and genuine. Like, they really felt like we had been watching them for a very long time because they just built it up so well. And even though we've known them for such a short time, the moment was like so nicely done and so touching that you really just felt things watching it.
The Flash and Legends can't relate.
Yeah. Exactly.
Womp.
And I also liked how they showed us how different Flex was too, and how he gave into the ant farm to save his wife. So their last moments together were even more emotional because of that. I liked Larry willing to let the spirit go, even if that possibly meant the end of his own life. Like, all that development finally paid off. And it was nice to see how far they've come and how the negative spirit decided to stay with Larry anyway, despite all of Larry's previous behavior. So I feel like they're finally on the same page now, in which they want to willingly work with each other versus like Larry antagonizing the spirit. Cliff asking for an update on Jane and the underground was actually really nice, like, especially since you could tell he was making an effort to speak gently when bringing it up. And I like that he apologized to her and told her he'd stop pressuring her to talk about it, but that he offered to listen when or if, you know, Jane ever needed the support. It was very mature of him and thoughtful, and I'm glad he's grown so much as a person and isn't constantly whining about everything all the time anymore. So that's a really nice change. The reveal of Rita's story, I agree, was really heartbreaking and tragic. It wasn't what I expected either, like, in terms of the baby stuff, because I thought that the baby would have been hers because she kept seeing it, so I assumed something had happened. Maybe it was like an
accident. I really thought she killed the baby.
Yeah, I did too.
You legit thought she killed a baby. That killed his baby so you could be in this movie. Okay.
But I like being surprised. So when I think back, and when I think back to when Rita was in the producer's office in that flashback scene after her accident, and how she ended up killing the producer while the secretary looked the other way, knowing he was a sexual predator, makes this frame.
Was that the same producer? Was that Gene too?
I don't know. I can't remember his name, but it might have been. But if it was, like, it makes the story come into sharper focus. In that moment, I really felt, like, the weight of her guilt and the relief she felt getting something like that off of her chest after all of these years. Like, she's been trying to ignore and block these moments from her life for so long, but now that she's finally taking, action instead of walking away like she did the last time. And the reveal that the old man was Mr. Nobody was annoying him only because she'd revealed all of that to him. And they're all walking right into the trap that he's laid out for them. And then finally, Cliff's terrible acting from that 80s show was hilarious. And the fact that he kept bringing up how close he was to winning that daytime Emmy for his performance was even more funny. The vegetable, animal, mineral man, and how he was shot in his minerals.
That was hilarious.
And by Von Fuchs, one of the Von Fuchs, that bit of continuity will never not be funny. But what do we not like about the episode?
I complain a lot about not having a lot of Vic, and he wasn't around a lot in this episode, which honestly was fine in this instance. Because it makes sense that he would be by his dad and worried about him. But I did find it a little tedious and a little bit annoying that he spent the whole episode saying, oh, no, I can't. I won't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. Granted, it's bad. I can't. I won't. And Rita's like, but we need you. No, I can't. I can't do it. So it's like a broken record for an entire episode of him saying all the reasons why he can't do it and why he won't do it and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then finally at the end, it's like, okay, I'll do it, but I won't go with you, but I'll do it. So I just found that just a little bit repetitive. And it didn't really go anywhere until the end when it clearly needed to go somewhere. So that was kind of I could have done with half of that maybe in the episode. So there was that. And I also, even though he's definitely changed into a better person, I was once again reminded how Larry was the worst TM in the beginning of his relationship with Negative Man. And I know that Negative Man is usually used to refer to the spirit, but it could literally be applied to Larry himself because he's just so negative and so defeatist during much of his time at the ant farm. And you just seeing this flashback with him in Flex and Tallow, if he had just taken some time to step outside of his own pity party and help Flex by, like, loosening up the straps or whatever was, like, dampening his powers, he could have been free, like, a long time ago. They both could have been free. And so it just felt so exasperated, and because I know, like, watching the flashbacks, you know that he's not going to get out because clearly he's been there for a while. And you just feel, like, so exasperated, as I'm sure the spirit did, at the fact that not only can it not communicate with Larry, but Larry was so uninterested in even attempting to assist in escape, which would have saved both of their lives, would have been for both of their mutual benefit, and they both wouldn't have been tortured. And, like, if he even, like, gotten out of his own way, maybe it would have occurred to him to have Flex translate what the spirit was saying, because Flex and the spirit are clearly having conversations, and if Larry does not know what the spirit wants, he could have asked Flex, like, by the way, what the fuck is the spirit saying, because I don't understand. And, like, there could have been so many opportunities for Larry and the spirit to connect so much earlier if Larry hadn't been so self-absorbed in his own guilt and pity party and all his kind of his own negativity. And it also made me mad because I really like Flex. And so the fact that Larry had the opportunity to save Flex and Flex was willing to, even being like trapped down with all of the whatever stuff that was dampening his powers, Flex was still able to flex and open up a wall to kind of see them. They could kind of get out. And so I'm just even more mad now, knowing what happened to Flex, that Larry had a chance to help him escape and didn't do it. So yeah, I'm trying to like separate Larry from the present from Larry from the past, but Larry from the past just made remind me why I don't like Larry all that much. That's probably it. Probably.
I there wasn't much for me to dislike about this episode, and I even forgot to mention in my likes Mineral Man, who was amazing. Like you lady said, the continuity between him and Von Fuchs, and just like people watching news reports about his adventures, was wonderful. And of course, the fourth wall breaking for Mr. Nobody. I liked that even he was just like waiting for a big villain superhero fight. Right.
Yeah.
So he's like actually actively building them up in order to be able to get them to the part where they can fight him. I thought that was really funny. But if I have to,
he's like bored too. That's kind of funny. Like he's bored. Like wait, like come on, people, finally.
Right. He's like, I did this so we could fight. Let's fight. But what I didn't like, if I have to choose, Vic. So like, I don't like that he didn't get very much to do after his father, you know, almost died. But then, like you said, Jessica, what he did get was like, no, I'm not gonna re-upload the thing. And it's like, I thought we already established, like, at the very beginning, you're like, oh, he just wanted to protect me. I know that he wanted me to do this for my own good, but I'm still not going to do it. So I was like, what more do you need? You already understand that it's for your own good. And then at the end, when he was like, oh, I'll do this, but I'm not going to join you guys on the quest or whatever. So I was like, I really hope that we're going to split the final two episodes, I guess it is, between, like, whatever Vic is doing. You know, like, that'll lead to a plot line versus the nobody fight. Because otherwise, it's just, like, a reason to not have Vic in the last two episodes.
And then the fact that Mr. Nobody went through the specific purpose of burning Vic's face off the poster.
Yes. Was I was like, petty. Yeah, that was petty. But also, like, I thought that was funny from his perspective. But, like, if it's, like, them saying that he's not going to be in the next two episodes, then I don't like that. So I guess we'll find out. If I like it or not. But right now I was like, and then it's like, I know that Vic/Cyborg doesn't actually really have a history with the Doom Patrol in the comics. Mm-hmm. So it's like all the more reason, like, why did y'all put him in Doom Patrol and not in Titans in the first place? Like, obviously Doom Patrol is a better show than Titans, but that doesn't mean that Doom Patrol has been using Vic that well. So, we'll see. Then everything you said about Negative Man and Larry is correct. Like, first off, Larry was a huge asshole, and I didn't need the reminder that he's the worst and that he's never like trying to understand Negative Man. I liked that he realized that this episode, and he was like, wow, I've been the worst to you. Like, you could have escaped like billions of years ago and I held you back or whatever, you know? But then his response to that now would be like, fly free. Go fly free, spirit. I'm just going to die now. And I was like, this is so dramatic. Obviously.
And I felt like the whole, like, the spirit could have left a long time ago. Exactly. Probably wanted to leave a long time ago, but he can't because it will die.
Exactly.
He spent the whole part of the flashback setting that up.
Whatever the reason is, like, whether he's going to die or whether he just doesn't want to, you know, like, we don't know. Like, I assume that, like you, I assume that he just can't live without Larry. It's a symbiotic relationship. But even if that wasn't the case and it just didn't want to, like, the spirit can leave. We've literally seen that happen. So you don't need to be kicking it out of its home. If it wants to go, it will. So I don't know. I thought that was really weird. It's like the opposite problem of Jane, right? I don't know. Like, Jane's issue is like, no, my personalities are going to do whatever they want, whenever they want. And I'm not even going to try to be like a unified force with them. Just going to act like a crazy person all the time. As opposed to Larry being like, I don't know. I'm trapping you. And then, we are nothing. Go away. So I don't know. It's like, even when he's trying to give him freedom, he's like giving it he's controlling it.
Forcefully, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I like that. I mean, I liked that it came back at the end, but I was still like, you don't even deserve for it to come back. You should just die. I was like, Rita, like, I'm so glad that you're fine, Larry, but can we please move on? So yes, there you go.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with my sentiments about Vic. I think while the episode did work, like, and I know Vic was at the hospital watching over his dad, but it did frustrate me how the episode gave us, like, Flex's backstory and pretty much told us he'll be a part of the last two episodes while Vic sat out for most of it. And it's even more frustrating because it seems like everyone else's growth is finally building up to something, but Vic is still unable to really move forward in the same way. And I'm sincerely worried he'll be completely missing from, like, the final two episodes, or at least only show up until, like, the end to help out. But I do hope that I'm wrong. And it's just really unfortunate that the writers had to kill off Dolores for Flex to finally become, like, angry and want to take action. Because I think that there are other ways that they could have done
Did
that.
Did he become angry? Because, like, it felt like the Doom Patrol left without him. So.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's another thing. Like, what was the point? I enjoyed the ride, but at the end, like, Flex didn't even help them get anywhere closer to the Chief, so.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that and, like, it just didn't need to happen, I guess, if he wasn't just gonna go with them, like you said. So, I don't know. There were just other ways to do that, especially since they spent so much time apart, and now that they got their reunion, she had to go, which really sucks. Predictions.
I guess that will be my prediction, that there actually was a reason for Flex Mentallo in this episode, and that he does do something in the next episode that validates why they had to find him specifically.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, they saw him a little bit of what his power was, and they're like, yes! But then, like, we don't know if he's even, how he's going to direct it, so. Because I guess my prediction, sort of, it's like, Niles Calder used to work for the Bureau of Normalcy.
The Bureau of Oddities that became the Bureau of Normalcy.
Yes, the Bureau of Oddities that became the Bureau of Normalcy. So was his encounter with Mr. Nobody, that Mr. Nobody's mad about, was that related to the Bureau of Oddities, or was that after the fact when he was trying to...
Or, like, were they both in the Bureau of Oddities and then Mr. Nobody created the Bureau of Normalcy? Because there's right. that, like, fuzzy period where something yeah. happened.
Yeah, so, like, something... Basically, I think that the backstory of the Bureau of Normalcy, because it's gotten so big in the last few episodes, that Mr. Nobody has to be connected to it, too. And yeah. that would also be why they need Flex Mentallo and why he would be of use in the fight against Mr. Nobody. Because at this point, the only person that... or thing, entity that he's mad at, or should be mad at, is the Bureau of Normalcy, because they're the ones that ruined his life and killed Dolores, etc. So, if he's got the choice between, like, he's there, Mr. Nobody's there, and Niles is there, Niles is the one that's actually part of, you know, was ever part of the Bureau, so I would feel like he'd, like, it'd be easier to turn him against Niles unless there's something with Mr. Nobody going on, and the Bureau, is what I'm saying. Yes. So, we are going to learn more about the Bureau of Normalcy in terms of Mr. Nobody and how he originated from them or created them in turn.
Solid predictions. Our Lady with Gumption Side B nominee. Who will it be?
It's going to be Killer Frost for standing up for a full minute. A full minute! aside from that, the clear winner of this week, I would say... And this is hard. Legends? Okay, is there anyone on Legends? It's Charlie for making them play the Ray games?
Well, it's the only thing that she did, I think, was pretend to be Mick to try to apologize to Sarah.
Which was awesome. I forgot to mention that.
It was actually Sarah's idea. Sarah and Mick, when they had their kind of, like, revelation to do, like, the whole Ray scenario and have fun as a team.
Yeah, yeah. I think Mona for Legends.
Yeah, Mona for Legends.
Mona
she,
for Legends, yeah.
She stood around in the Bureau. She saved everyone from
she
Gary's
actually
nipple.
Have gumption for that. She so yay for that. And then I think both Jane and Rita had some strong points in Doom Patrol. I don't know if one was more gumption-y than the other.
And, I mean, even though it was like, oh, do we have one for the Flash? Because I was going to say Nora, but just even if it was like all dumb, whatever.
I mean, like, it was, she, like, yeah, fine, it was dumb, but she had the gumption to like.
She was finally taking action and being active and trying to like stop stuff from happening. So
she still not going to win, but she did have. She did have gumption.
The attempt
The attempt was made. She did go out of her way to find and connect with Grace and have their shared temper tantrum in the little mind realm. So whatever. So yeah, full slate. We can drop some of these. First one, we already dropped Nora, so bye Nora.
And I would drop Rita and
Jane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is Nora, Mona
this week.
Mona and Lena?
Yep.
Okay.
I feel more strongly about one than the other, but I also feel like I should defend the other one because I don't like Mona most of the time, but I think that
this one, she made a clear effort to.
Yeah.
She noticed, she was the only one that noticed the problem, and then she went out of her way to try to solve it. She recruited people to try to help her solve it. She got captured, and then even when she was brought before the almighty Gary, and she had a plan on how to, like, escape and all this kind of stuff. So I was really proud of her in this episode in particular. But I have so many strong feelings for Lena.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's how I am, too. Like, I obviously have stronger feelings about and for Lena, and I was like, yeah, Lena, throughout the episode. But I think that Mona's story was just like contained without strings attached to it, you know?
Yeah.
Like she was actually in control, and turning the tables in that situation instead of like being put in a position where she has to be the hero because she doesn't know that she's got the actual hero with her who's actually like landing the plane for her.
Well, she did beat Eve on her own.
She did beat
Eve. She did beat Eve on her own. And I love, like, Dominatrix Lena with her little baton and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. So okay, I mean, so either one is
going,
a good choice.
Are we going with Mona? Is that what's happening? Because I feel like that's,
I mean,
what's going on.
Going with Mona has, like, you can't put Lena and Mona on the same pedestal because, like, the stakes in both stories are completely different. And as much as I am proud of Mona, I think, just going back to what I was saying earlier about Lena's backstory and what friendship means to her and how the length that she's gone through to protect that, and that was like on full display definitely here, and the responsibility she's trying to take for her brother being the one to be behind this plot, and the fact that, you know, she was going above and beyond because she thought that she had to protect Kara and herself. She's just emotionally, it's a stronger story.
Mm-hmm. I agree. With
I
that.
Agree.
All right. Lena is our Lady with Gumption of the Week for episode 83. Once again, you can contact us on Twitter or tweet along with us on our, you know, TV show nights at DCTV Gumption. Send us your asks to ladieswgumption.tumblr.com or any emails to ladieswgumption@gmail.com. And we will be back next week for most of the finales. And we will see you next week, or you'll hear us next week. Bye.
Bye. Bye.